and gentlemen, it's the Stephanie Miller Show.
It's the Stephanie Miller Show, coming to you live today from New York City at the corner of Crack House and Porn Shop. I am John Fugelsang, filling in for the lovely Ms. Miller, along with Chris Lavoie, in the home base back in beautiful Burbank, California.
Hiya.
Hi, Chris. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Very good. Thank you. It's great to be filling in for Steph. I want to let people know Steph is fine. It's just I didn't think it was possible she could still be drunk on Monday morning, but that's how good the Boston show was.
I heard it was really, really good.
It was a fantastic show. We'll get to it right after I tell all the folks out there in Steffland that this hour of the Stephanie Miller Show is brought to you by GoToMeeting.com. Chris, how much do I love GoToMeeting? It's reliable, it's fast,
yep.
It's easy to use, and hopefully we can stage an intervention for Steph using GoToMeeting at some point so we don't have to be in the same room as her.
Yes, indeed.
GoToMeeting.com. Check it out. Improve your life now. Chris, how are you this morning?
I'm doing well. Survived Carmageddon here in Los Angeles.
Yes, for those of you who don't know, they closed down the 405 freeway, 10 miles of the 405 freeway, which links the disgusting part of L.A. to the smoggy part of L.A.
Yeah.
And, wow, I can't even imagine. I heard that there were thousands of terrified Angelenos calling into the news and 911 wondering why there was a blue coloring to the sky.
Yeah, yeah, it was a beautiful, beautiful weekend. There was no traffic anywhere. Yeah, I live nowhere near the 405, and there is no traffic. So people just stayed home, stayed in their own neighborhoods, and or even got out of town. So
On Friday, I was relentlessly telling Stephanie that she had to leave like hours early. We were so terrified with L.A. being just completely on lockdown that she would never make it to her flight. But the show in Boston might have been the best show we ever had. It was
a fantastic
crowd. Yeah, it was a great crowd. The Wilbur Theater is a dynamite space, and it's sort of like, you know, we've done the show both in medium-sized venues and in these huge, you know, 2,500-seat theaters.
Right.
And this is in the middle. It was like a 800-900-seater with club seating on the floor. So it was like the first time I ever really saw Stephanie do the show in what looked like a massive, huge club.
Yeah.
Rock bands play there. National headliners play there. The woman was on fire. I mean, and I'm not even just talking about what happens in menopause. I mean, she was like burning up the stage. She was so hot. And just a dynamite set. Stephanie Miller is becoming an even better physical comedian on stage than she was when this tour began, this unholy experiment.
Awesome. Very good for her.
Yeah. So it's, again, go to Sexy Liberal on Twitter or Facebook to learn more about the tour. But phase one of the Steph tour has ended, and she's recovering from really fighting off groupies is pretty much what it was about.
Yeah, with a stick.
I've begun telling everyone on the radio, if you're a Stephanie Miller groupie and you come to one of the shows, just go for it. Hit on her. Go after her. And she now carries around a cricket bat to fight them off.
Good. <We're laughs> And a cricket bat's hard to find in the United States.
It's as hard to find as a soccer fan, and it'll be harder to find now that the women's team is not going to the World Cup finals. I'm very disappointed about this. As you know, all I care about is women's soccer, and I guess the only good news about them losing is that Americans don't have to start pretending they care about women's soccer, but it would have been great to see them in there.
Yeah, yeah, I guess I didn't see the game, but I guess it was a great game, and we lost it only on penalty kicks.
Well, you know more than I do. That's the sports portion of today's show.
Yeah, exactly.
we'll come back to that after hip-hop news later.
I played youth soccer as a child and really didn't know what I was doing, but I knew that there were penalty kicks, so.
Yeah, same with me. I kept scoring goals for the other team, and I was not invited back. There's so much to talk about in America today between the debt ceiling, between Rupert Murdoch, which is going to be a lot of fun, between Hamid Karzai's creepy family, and between the fact that my plot to make J-Lo single is coming along perfectly. To make sense of all of this, I asked Mr. Chris Lavoie if we could begin the Stephanie Miller show today with a close friend of the show. Of course, I'm talking about Mr. David Bender. Is Mr. Bender present?
He is here.
Let's bring him on,
Mr. Bender, present and accounted for.
Good morning, David Bender. How are you, sir?
I am doing great, and congratulations on Boston. You know what really happened? I don't know if you were involved in meeting Stephanie at the other end, but we actually got her walking to Boston. She started walking, and that's what great shape this woman is in. She started walking on Friday after the show, and she made it in time.
Yep.
I had no idea. Well, you know, I really think that this concert is, this show we're doing is really, really dynamic. I mean, when we began the tour, it was me trying to trick Stephanie and Hal into doing this, because I feel like there are so many people out there who identify as progressive or liberal or independent or sane or not evil, or Democrats. And, you know, in many parts of this country, it can feel really isolating. I know right now there's people listening to this show wondering why I'm on, and also, you know, just thinking, like, how hard it is to have a Barack Obama bumper sticker on your car when you go to your job or your church, and you've got the right-wing creep in the cubicle next to you, you've got that neighbor who's got a fetish for bald eagle imagery, and very often it can feel as a sane progressive that it's pretty lonely out there, and I thought there's never been a progressive political comedy tour before. I don't know why Daily Show hasn't done it, but hey, why don't we do it? And so I called up Steph and Hal, and they're the funniest people in the world, and you know, we put together a nice little team, and now the tour has been really successful, and we've been invited back every place we've played, and you know, I'm really, really proud of it, and it's great to see what a great comedian Stephanie is on stage, and how much fun her crowds have meeting her. So I hope you'll come, David Bender.
But I'll tell you something. A lot of people identify as liberal or progressive in this country don't feel a connection. And up until yesterday, I guess, Mark Anthony identified as sexy. But that's over now.
And he is in a Tolkien character kind of way, I guess. Yeah. I always thought he just got lost in J-Lo's extensions.
There's no credit for that anymore. It's done. His stick a fork in his sexiness.
Well, every time he stands next to J-Lo, he looks like Cousin It, because her extensions just kind of cover him, and he just like sticks his little hands out from her. So I hope it'll be a good chance for him to branch out on his career. But you know what, David?
And did you see that they're doing the reality show still? So this is America in the new millennium. You can get a divorce, but you can keep custody of your reality show.
I had no idea. They're doing a reality show, the two of them?
The two of them.
Even though they're broken up?
Yeah, apparently. It's something called, and maybe they're producing it, but they're working together. It's called, and that assumes they'll appear on, it's called K-Viva, I think, something like that.
Oh, really?
And yeah, they announced, the important thing they announced was that their show will go on even if they do not.
Wow.
They're
well,
like
I,
the Lucy and Desi of our era. I'm so encouraged.
I can't wait. I just can't wait to ignore my family and my children to watch that show. Of all the ways to waste my life with reality TV, a fake reality show with a fake married couple, fantastic. You know, David, here's the thing. I don't think people ever set out to be liberal. I don't think people ever set out to say, hey, I want to be ahead of my time. I want to take currently unpopular positions for moral reasons. And I want to have guys who have way too many flags on their notebook tell me I'm not a patriot. But I think every now and then people realize, wait a second, I'm smart, I'm moral, I'd rather my tax dollars help people here than blow them up over there, and my taste in music isn't completely crappy. Oh, my God, I'm a liberal. And it can be lonely sometimes in liberal land, and that's why I'm glad to have a guy like you around who is such a terrific writer and keen observer of what's going on in the scene. There's a lot to talk about on this morning's show, and I want to begin asking you to bring us up to speed, because we were off in Boston all weekend having a Chardonnay-soaked time with Stephanie Miller. If I got a contact high from wine. I don't know how that happens. But if you can keep us updated on what's going on with Rupert Murdoch and Rebecca Brooks.
Well, you know, it's interesting that this is, I am old enough, as I said many times, to remember what happened with Warren Harding, because, you know, I kept getting calls from Mrs. Harding.
You are not old enough to remember Warren Harding, okay? You saw that on Boardwalk Empire.
Let me just say, it was ugly back during Teapot Dome. This is ugly for Rupert Murdoch, and it is happening, frankly, in that same sort of slow-moving traffic accident that you can analogize to. People, of course, are calling it his Watergate, where drip by drip, bits and things keep coming out. Tomorrow, mm-hmm. Rupert and his son James, his youngest son, who is running the Murdoch Empire, he runs News Corp,
yes.
Will be testifying before the Committee of Inquiry in the Parliament. What happened, I guess, Friday now, when you were in Boston soaked in Chardonnay, is that Rebecca Brooks, who ran News of the World, the paper, the 160-plus-year-old newspaper that
Rupert's own protege, this very attractive redheaded woman that he brought up from the ranks. and put in charge of
it. That's right. She has been his protege. She is the person who actually was. There's a lot of hacking and taping going on even after the hacking scandal, because she called together a meeting of the employees of News of the World and said, you know, tried to defend herself, said this happened. I heard about the same way you did. I wasn't involved in any of it. And employees were piping up. It was kind of like one of those question sessions in Parliament, and you could hear the people on this secret tape saying, "How can we work for you anymore? No one respects you." And
wow.
She went forward for a few days saying, "I had nothing to do with this. We're going to keep running the company," but she was ballast, and he tossed her overboard. The question now,
what a shock that this is all happening, by the way, the week the movie Horrible Bosses is released in theaters.
Yeah.
It's kind of like China Syndrome and Three Mile Island. You're seeing these things as linked, right? This is all
yes.
A studio promotion. If Fox has released Horrible Bosses, then I think we've got a much bigger scandal on our hands. Here's what is truly going on is that Murdoch is 80 years old now, John, and
yes.
He has always been a fighter. He's been a scrapper.
And that's in Middle Earth years, correctly?
Those are the Middle Earth. It's every time, and we're back to Gollum. Every time there has been a challenge to him, he has dug in his heels. What he did this past week was to take out full page ads and say, you know, we're sorry. I'm sorry. And our job was to monitor what people do. We did not monitor ourselves. We did not hold ourselves accountable. And that's why they folded News of the World. Here's the problem. The problem is that this is politics 101. This is what Harding didn't get. This is what Nixon didn't get. This is what Anthony Weiner didn't get, which is it is not as bad as the phone hacking and probable payoffs to police officials in London to keep it hushed up. As bad as all that is, it is the cover-up that kills you.
Yeah.
And that is still going on here, which is why it will be this drip, drip, drip of announcements of other people going. And remember, Nixon, some time before he resigned, cut off the people he referred to as his right arm and his other right arm, Haldeman and Ehrlichman.
Yep.
His two loyalist guys, the people who've been with him since the early 60s, he threw to the wolves to save himself. That's what we're seeing with Rupert Murdoch. The question is, Murdoch has done it now with Rebecca Brooks. He's done it with Les Hinton, who has the guy who had been at News of the World, who crossed the pond, who was running the company that owns the Wall Street Journal. So we're now connecting the dots up to the U.S. part of News Corp. Les Hinton and Rebecca Brooks gone, Rebecca Brooks arrested. What we're going to wonder about now, and we're going to see it play out tomorrow, and this will be really, really interesting, is will a member of Murdoch's family, his youngest son, his heir apparent, will he be the next sacrificial lamb to save Rupert? Will he do that to his own son?
Okay, fantastic. Well, hang on, David. David, I want you to hang on. We're going to ask you a lot more about that and when we come back from the break. Okay, we have a lot more coming up. David Bender, I'm glad you're with us. I have a lot more tasteless jokes. If you don't know about Rupert Murdoch, it means you probably watch Fox News, so keep it here. We'll be covering everything in the world, and we'll be right back just after this. It's the Stephanie Miller Show.
This is a disgusting display.
Oh, you can say that again.
It's the Stephanie Miller Show. Stephanie Miller.
Hey. It's the Stephanie Miller Show. I'm John Fugelsang, filling in for Stephanie Miller yet again, in spite of popular demand.
Oh, this stop hour, it. They
love
you.
This hour, Stephanie Miller Show is brought to you by the breast milk baby doll that's causing a bit of a stir after its maker announced plans to sell it in U.S. toy stores.
Oh.
Of course, I'm kidding, but this is a real doll. Have you heard about this, Chris and David Bender? Have you heard about the breast milk baby?
I haven't.
No.
It's on Beast today, on Daily Beast. The doll's owner wears a special halter top with flowers on the nipples, and when you hold the baby doll up to one of the flowers, it makes sucking sounds, and it's made by a Spanish company. It's a bestseller in Europe. Believe it or not, some people don't think this is the best toy for children. And having the
you know, honestly, John, if I wasn't gay before, I am now.
I think I am too, actually, David. I think I'm ready to go get my international mail catalog after reading about this, because the nipple-sucking baby doll is probably the most ill-advised toy I've heard of since the Harry Potter vibrating broom for girls, which came out a couple of years ago. And
yeah,
you know,
enough said about that.
Yeah, let's.
I know we're up against a heartbreak. Can I do a quick shout out, because the Sexy Liberal Show started in Madison, Wisconsin.
That's right.
Yeah.
And I want to give a quick shout out to our friends in Madison, Wisconsin. I hope they're listening on the mic, because you guys are doing an amazing job all over the state of Wisconsin. That election is coming up in just a few weeks, August 9th, and it's looking like there's a real chance that they're going to flip control of the state Senate in Wisconsin, and it started with you and Stephanie and Hal.
Oh, I take all credit for it.
Show.
I take all the credit for that. Thank you. I will take credit for Governor Walker being... Look, here's what I always say. Governor Walker can't recall caring about the workers of Wisconsin, but the workers of Wisconsin care about recalling Governor Walker. And when I was on the show a few months ago, and I've been trying to talk Stephanie and Hal into doing this tour for a year, and they kept saying to me the same thing, how did you get this number? And so finally, on the air, I said, let's bring the damn Sexy Liberal Tour to Madison. We had so many great, dynamic people in Wisconsin write us saying, yes, we got offers to do it. I brought in Roland the Booker. We booked the date, had a couple of great shows. And it's like, I can't wait to go back, because I think that Wisconsin is the epicenter of the rebirth of the labor movement in this country. If it's going to happen, it's going to happen here.
It's more than the labor movement. It is the progressive movement, which started in Wisconsin. It is not even now just about labor. It's about values and progressive values and people coming together and getting out and taking their democracy back. And let's encourage all of our friends out there who are doing this to let you know that the rest of the country is watching you and supporting you and pulling for you on August 9th. It is a big, big day for the country.
Absolutely. And you know who the unsung heroes of this movement are? And I got to be honest with you, and you guys might not like it, but I really think it's sane Republicans who have crossed over. Sane Republicans who voted for this guy Walker because he was their guy. And then they realized, hey, this guy never campaigned on taking collective bargaining away from teachers. What is this? This guy never said he was going to do this. And a lot of sane Republicans who realize the fraud of Scott Walker saying that teachers having collective bargaining hurts a budget deficit, but tax breaks for millionaires who don't need them doesn't. And I think that we saw so many Republican brothers and sisters showing up at these rallies and lending their support to the Democrats and independents. And I think that's what's going to ultimately swing the deal.
Well, I agree with you completely. Those same Republicans are now called independents.
That's right.
They've led their party, but that's who they are.
Yeah, sane Republicans are called independents. Embarrassed Republicans are now called libertarians, which we love.
Yeah.
Well, okay, David Bender, are you sticking around for one more block?
We have the Rude Pundit actually coming up.
Then we're kicking David Bender out of here.
Coming up, it's always a pleasure. Give the Rude Pundit my greatest rudeness. And have a great show.
All right.
It's the Stephanie Miller Show, Rude Pundit, coming up right after this break.
Boy, I'm really looking forward to this. I really need some...
Stephanie Miller.
After the week I've had.
It is the Stephanie Miller Show. Coming today with 100% less Stephanie Miller. I'm John Fugelsang, filling in for Steph. She's still, you know, drying out after the weekend we had with the Stephanie Miller Sexy Liberal Tour in Boston.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm here with you for the full 3 hours this morning, along with the great Chris Lavoie. How are you, Chris?
I'm doing well. Did you have some lobster?
I had no lobster. No, I had. We had no time at all. We do this tour, and I kept thinking I was going to get to see the country, and I love Boston. The audience was amazing, and Boston, I went to BU when I was younger, and I fell in love there for the first time.
Aww.
And I used to work for the NBC affiliate, and I had my heart torn out by someone who destroyed me in Boston, and I have so many great memories, and
I worked at the largest record store in New England in Boston.
Really?
Yeah, Strawberry's Records before before Tower Records opened up.
I wound up watching Jane Eyre in the hotel on pay-per-view. That was about as exciting as my day got.
Oh.
And it was a lot of show prep going on for the
okay.
For the big tour. I for those who don't know, I pretty much do mostly Jeff Foxworthy's act, and I just steal it, and I throw in jokes about teabaggers instead. And so I'm not a very original performer at all. And it led to comedy greatness, but it's really just me spending hours and hours researching Larry the Cable Guy routines and changing the punchlines.
Aha, uh-huh. Very cool.
Yeah, this is how we do it. just like how Steph just pretty much steals Neil Bortz's act and adds fart sounds.
Yeah.
So, speaking of stealing Neil Bortz's act, I'm very pleased to welcome to the show the one and only Rude Pundit.
Lee Papa, the Rude Pundit. Pundit.
Good morning, Rude. How you be?
I'm good. Now, Bortz is a lot more jowly than I am.
That is true.
Yeah. Yes. Lee Papa, it's always a pleasure to have you on the show. You're so rude in your punditry, and I really admire the way that you take no prisoners, and your subtlety is what really draws me into your columns. And you've had some great ones in the last week. There's so much to talk about. We just had David Bender on, and we're talking a bit about Rupert Murdoch. I actually phoned Rupert Murdoch over the weekend to complain about the hacking scandal, and he told me to back off or he'd change all my passwords. So I felt bad about it. But I want to know your take on Rupert, and do you think this will affect Fox News and the Murdoch empire in America?
Well, I mean, now there's reports that possibly Jude Law and David Beckham had their phones hacked in the United States.
And if
that happened, then all bets are off. I don't understand. I mean, I guess that the Justice Department at this point is looking into how big an investigation to launch, but I don't understand why this isn't just time to go out guns blazing and get the bad guy for the Obama administration, and frankly, probably for many people on the right who are constantly cowed by the power of the Murdoch machine.
Well, that I want to ask you about that, because I really think the reason why it's taken this long to happen is because politicians are terrified of the man, and I think that's especially true in this country. I don't think you're going to see Eric Holder launching a full-fledged investigation until they know they've got something really dirty on the guy, because let's say that Obama goes after him, it leads to nothing. Can you imagine? Can you imagine the hell and brimstone that Murdoch will rain down on anybody who went after him if he dodges this bullet?
Well, the problem is, though, that the corner that the Murdoch empire is painted into at this point is they have done something wrong. And even if they did it in England, and I think that it's only reasonable to think that if you know your serial killer lived somewhere for a while, you might want to check their yard for bodies. So. I think it's a win-win situation. I think you discredit Murdoch by having an investigation that says, well, this was the standard practice of one of his newspapers over there, at least one, possibly two or more. Why shouldn't we expect that to be over here?
But here's the thing, you know, my favorite non-drinking game has come to be watching Fox News and having a drink every time they say the word hacking, because you'll be sober enough to be everyone's designated driver.
Yeah, you could do that with heroin. That would actually probably even out.
Yes, actually, you could go clean off methadone by only taking some when they mention the hacking scandal on Fox News. Ducey, to his credit, did bring it up, and he just said, we've got some serious problems in this country, and this is what they do. They talk about this, and then he went back to Casey Anthony. You know, I don't know if it benefits the Democratic Party to go after Rupert Murdoch just yet, because the average Fox viewer, I would submit to you, has no idea who Rupert Murdoch is or what his reputation is. They know what Hannity says. They like what O'Reilly says. They don't know who the evil overlord of Mordor is telling them what to do. And it doesn't affect them yet. And until you can make a dent in this empire, I don't think you're going to see a lot of American Democrats going after the guy.
Well, that's where the FBI investigation could be really interesting. That's looking into whether or not the allegation that they hacked into the phones of 9/11 victims is true.
Do you think that's true? Do you really think that that happened in 2001?
I don't put anything past them. At this point, I wouldn't be surprised if what they've done is one of the ways in which he stays in power is having hacked into the phones of all of these politicians and executives of other companies and keeps a file on them. At this point, who knows? I mean, when you get to hacking into the phone of terrorist attack survivors,
right,
you're really beyond the pale. You're really in any kind of wild conspiracy can be possible.
But we need
so
to stress that none of this is proven
it?
Yet. It's all still rumors, though, right? That 9/11 victims may have been hacked.
Right. The 9/11 victims thing is that the FBI is looking into it. And in fact, a couple of Republicans have gotten on board with that. Peter King from New York has gotten on board saying, look, we need to make sure that this didn't happen.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the one thing that could dent the teabaggers' blind associations with Fox News, is if the sainted 9/11 victims had their phones hacked.
It's true, although, again, I would submit to you that there's still a disconnect in this country, and people think of Fox News and they think of Sean Hannity. They don't think of Rupert Murdoch yet, and I don't see how they can make this stick. I mean, when you look at what Bill O'Reilly got away with tape recorded phone conversations and how it
right.
cost his boss $5 million and no one cared in his audience. I think that England is especially abstract to the average Fox viewer.
And that I agree with completely. But I do think that if you are able to invoke that 9/11 victim status, then you are into something else. Because one of the things that Fox has done is propagate that the feelings of 9/11 victims take precedence over anything, over construction, over religious freedom. So I think that's where the ass bite could come in.
Exactly right. Now let's go to the debt ceiling, I think, because I love Fox and I love beating up on Fox. I think they're a mecca for people who hate mecca. But the debt ceiling is obviously the big story. It's going to continue being the big story for at least another 2 weeks. The press seems to be starting to suggest that Obama's winning on this and that he is going to get away with having a slight tax increase on the upper 3%. Which would get rid of the deficit problems we're all worried about. You know, if you want to get rid of the deficit, all you have to do is let the Bush tax cuts expire as the Republicans and Bush planned for them to do in 2010. It's Bush's
right.
tax increase. You do that, and these problems go away. Do you see that happening, Rude?
Well, that's an interesting piece of the puzzle, isn't it? And at one point, didn't Obama even offer to permanently extend the Bush tax cuts as part of a grand bargain? And Republicans walked away from that. If you want a talking point for an ad, it's Republicans walked away from a permanent tax cut on everybody. So now he's essentially got to do nothing and allow the tax and the tax cuts will go away at the end of the year.
Well, you've got two schools of thought on this. When it comes to the left, at least, I guess you got the people who say Obama's a capitulator. If I wanted a punching bag, I would have voted for John Kerry. The guy's giving up on everything. He's caved so many times there are miners trapped inside of him. He's a Republican. You have that whole like Chris Lavoie, who got the Republicans elected. He feels that way.
Oh, sure.
And
on the
other hand, you've got the Obama loyalists who say no, he's playing 3D chess and you're just playing checkers, and he's got a master plan to end all this and bring the troops home and save Vietnam. And I think the truth probably lies somewhere in the middle. Either Obama made that offer to keep the Bush tax cuts permanent, knowing it would never happen, so he would have the pretense of being so willing to compromise with the Republicans, or he really, really meant it, and he betrayed everything the people who voted for him stood for.
Well,
people elected a guy who said he was going to let these tax cuts expire.
Well, and he betrayed that back when he extended them for a year. So
For two years.
So,
and again, I thought that was the biggest mistake he made.
Happened. At this point, we're sort of used to that. That's the smack we're used to. Now give us something new to feel betrayed about.
He's certainly done a very good job of making.
Don't worry, I'm actually with Chris on this. Don't worry, he will give us something to feel betrayed about.
Yeah.
Well, but that's the essence of compromise. I got to say, in all instances of compromise, every side should walk away feeling like they gave up something. And the guy has proven to his credit that he is willing to compromise. And I will also say, and I argue this to Stephanie all the time, throwing liberals under the bus is the best way for a Democrat to get elected or reelected. Whenever a Democrat wants people to know that he's not a liberal, that he's a moderate, just like you and me, they'll throw the liberals under the gay parade float. And we've seen it happen with every liberal president. It works. And the more liberals get angry at a Democratic president, the more moderates feel safer voting for him. So in the big picture, it does kind of work. Wouldn't you agree?
Oh yeah, that's the cynical nature of politics, isn't it? And but yet, for Republicans to get elected, they have. It seems like in many ways, the more irrational they appear at the right, they sort of ride a wave, a crest of a wave of irrationality that that washes them into office. What I want to know is where are all the irrational liberals? Because I turn on the TV all the time and I see completely insane conservatives constantly, and every purported liberal I see is always trying to be reasonable. And
right.
I want somebody that is the reverse of Herman Cain, who goes on Fox News and says it's okay to ban building mosques. You know, that's crazy.
Yeah.
And so I want a liberal I want a liberal on that side.
Yeah. Well, look, man, I'll believe the media is liberal when they cover an anti-war rally half as hard as a Tea Party rally. You know.
Yeah.
And I think that.
Or even when it's 10 times bigger than a Tea Party rally.
Well, exactly. And, you know, having Herman Cain come out and spout against Muslims, I mean, you know, he's red meat for the base. The Democrats haven't figured out how to do that yet. MSNBC wouldn't even let Dennis Kucinich take part in their presidential campaign debate in 2008, you know?
Yeah.
And it's absolutely crazy. I think you're right. But I have to say I'm terrified, Rude, that the real liberal, the moderate voice we're hearing in the media seems to be John Boehner.
How weird is that?
Yeah, I woke up and John Boehner's the moderate now.
Yeah, well, that's that pulling that line of moderation over to the right. I mean, right now, to if John Boehner's line has become left, then we really are screwed as a country.
Yeah.
True, but Eric Cantor is going to be comedy gold for a long time.
Just his glasses, the glasses and the hair. He's a walking caricature.
Yes,
indeed he is, and he's got a voice that makes Al Gore seem butch. Rude, tell all the folks out there about your book before we go to break.
You can buy my book. It's The Rude Pundit's Almanac. You can buy it at orbooks.com or at amazon.com. And it's got poetry. Yes, poetry.
Yes,
it's
poetry.
It's got analysis of the people campaigning for president, the candidate. Sorry, there's the word.
Yay.
And it's got personal stories of political awakenings and lots and lots of sodomy jokes.
Hooray!
It's hilarious, and I love your poem about Charles Krauthammer's hair, Ode on a Grecian Formula. Rude Pundit, always a pleasure to have you on the show. Thank you so much, and everyone check out the book. It's a riot.
Thanks a lot, John.
It's the Stephanie Miller Show. I'm John Fugelsang. It's more crazy than you can handle, and we'll be right back after this brief message.
She's your information slut. It's the Stephanie Miller Show. Stephanie Miller.
It's a beautiful day. Sky falls, you feel like it's a beautiful day. So let it get away.
It is the Stephanie Miller Show. I am John Fugelsang, filling in for Steph, along with Chris Lavoie in the L.A. Bureau. I'm coming to you from the New York Bureau at the corner of Plastic and Neon here in Times Square.
At the corner of Blade Runner and...
Blade Runner and Disney Store in Times Square. Yeah, it used to be the corner of Crack House and Porn Shop, but now it's a bit more wholesome or less, depending on your taste. Well, thanks for playing some U2 for me there, Chris.
Hey, no problem. No, we're getting away from
Chris
the metal.
Well, I write Chris at like 5 in the morning saying, like, you know, because I love doing the show with Hal, but then I know it's going to be the metal hour of you know, bands I've never heard of that are tonally indistinguishable to my untrained ear. And nothing against metal. I love metal. But thanks. So I write to Chris at like 5 in the morning saying, hey, man, can you play some Fabs and some U2 and some Velvet Underground and
some Florence and the Machine.
Florence and the Machine and whatever else kind of stuff I'm into. By the way, that new album by Danger Mouse, I think it's called Rome with Jack White and Norah Jones. Highly recommended,
really?
Kids. That's my musical pick of the week. It sounds like a border town Mexican Western soundtrack, and Norah Jones has never sounded better. Jack White's the man. And highly, highly recommended stuff.
Very cool. I will have to fetch that on Spotify.
Fetch it on Spotify, yeah. Now it's Spotify, man.
Yeah, I know.
I'm not
Last
even
week
Google
it was
Plus
Google
yet.
Plus, and this week it's Spotify.
Well, I have my Google Plus linked to my Spotify, and I link that to my Facebook page and my Facebook fan page and my Twitter page, and then I link that to my LinkedIn and my classmates.com, but not MySpace, dude, because I have a life.
That's
okay?
Right.
That's how it works. We are taking your calls at 1-800-STEF-1-2. And we are also taking your tweets at johnfuglesang.com. People are writing in some very, very funny things and some very nice things about how good a guest host Hal Sparks is when he does this. But I do want to say, who have we got here? Chavez writes, I'm a liberal and I don't think Obama has thrown us under the bus. He's only working with the hand he's been dealt. And that's a good point. I like watching Fox News because I like hearing how George Bush gets the credit for catching Osama bin Laden and Barack Obama gets the blame for the unemployment rate. Folks, blaming Obama for this economy is like Ike Turner blaming Tina for taking a punch, okay? It's like blaming the rescue boat because your captain hit an iceberg. It's blaming your hangover on the guy making breakfast. It takes a lot longer than 2 years to clean up 8 years of elephant crap, so go ahead and blame the guy with the broom. A lot of liberals are disappointed in Obama, but when you look at what Bush was handed, the surplus he was handed, and what he did with it, and then you look at what Obama's trying to do to clean up this guy's mess, how dare you? Every time you have a Republican coworker or friend say, oh, there you go, blaming Bush again, I want you to turn around and say to them, hey, pal, when are you going to start blaming Bush? When are you going to stop blaming the fire department and start blaming the arsonist? I really want to see the left, the independents, the sane people grow a pair and start pushing back on this. Because, damn it, yes, we will blame Bush, and we'll blame his owners who put him into the job as well.
Yep.
So say we all.
Yay.
Now, having said that, let's take a call from Aaron in Madison about a very, very important political issue facing all of us today, the breast milk-sucking baby doll. Good morning.
I actually have two things. One, the first recall election in Wisconsin is actually tomorrow. It's a Democrat trying to save his seat in Green Bay.
Mm-hmm.
So there's still things people can do to help there. But secondly,
like turn out to vote, right? Like everyone needs to sneak out of their job and show up and vote tomorrow.
Do their job, show up and vote, and if you don't live in the district, if you go through the Democratic Party of Wisconsin, you can find ways to help phone bank into the district from wherever you are in the state.
Yeah, there's ways you can help no matter where you are. And again,
exactly.
I think as Wisconsin goes, so goes the nation, and God bless you for doing the work you're doing. Let's get to the important stuff
now. An important thing, yeah. So my daughter was 3 when my son was born. And I have friends with kids, boys and girls. And when you have a younger sibling and you nurse as a mom, the older siblings all start sticking dolls up their shirt anyway.
They all start
so
what?
I would have been, they put dolls up their shirt and pretend to nurse their dolls.
Even the boys.
Really?
Even the boys, yeah. So, and it was really kind of a tricky thing to explain to my daughter, and it led to some really hilarious questions from her.
I'm sure.
Uh-huh.
And so I can't believe I'm defending this, but any way to help explain that to the toddler you have while you're nursing an infant, I'm kind of not against.
So having a plastic fake child that will suck at your nipples is good for the kids,
does
is what you're saying.
Your nipples? Maybe I'm misunderstanding what this is, because then I'm horrified.
Yeah. Well, wear a halter top with flowers on the nipples. That's how how it works.
Oh, God.
So,
okay, never mind. That's horrifying.
Okay, thank you.
Little kids try to nurse their babies, and that's okay. This thing apparently crosses a line.
Yeah, it does.
It's made by It's made by Berzouin Toys in Spain. They say it's a huge bestseller in Europe. You know, I'm the most open-minded guy out there. But really, really, I don't think, when we have such a huge teenage pregnancy rate to begin with, I don't think giving toddlers their first little suckling plastic infant is the most essential toy.
And is it teaching kids that their nipples are flowers?
Well, that's a good point. But have we discussed it?
I'm just telling you, boys and girls are nursing their dolls already.
Okay. Thank you, Aaron. I'm glad that we freaked you out and it didn't even involve naked pictures of me. That's a good thing. Yeah, it's again, we can blame Spain for this. And I don't think Spain gets blamed for enough, to be honest with you.
You're absolutely right.
All those bad Antonio Banderas movies, there's so much we can blame Spain for. They get off the hook all the time.
We can blame Spain for the rain on the plane.
Thank you. Yes, indeed, that rain on the plain. And because it's mainly in Spain, they don't share it, and there's irrigation problems. So, you know what, folks? Let's stop blaming gays who want to get married. Let's stop blaming Mexicans who want a better life. Let's start blaming Spain and Belgium for more random stuff.
There you go.
It's a good internationalist way of hate. Mark in San Francisco, are you there,
Actually, we have only have about 30 seconds left.
Well, then, in that case, we're going to take a break. We're going to be taking your calls when we come back at 1-800-STEP-12. There's so much to talk about between Murdoch, the debt ceiling, Japan is banning Fukushima meat.
That's right.
Really? You don't say. What a cunning idea.
And Eric Bollert joins us right after the top of the hour,
Eric Bollert will join us up to do the heroic Lord's work of Media Matters and talk about ways you can piss off the Breitbart man in your house.
Ladies and gentlemen, it's the Stephanie Miller Show.
Yes, oh yes, oh yes. It is a great Stephanie Miller Show being torn down to my level, as John Fugel saying. Ruining the airwaves for you this morning and tearing down the house that Steph built along with Chris Lavoie in the L.A. Bureau and the great Jim Ward.
That's French for the voie, by the way.
Yes.
Yeah.
The
no, voie. It means the way or the path.
El sendero luminoso.
I am the way, the path, and something. Yeah.
I look forward to your literature for your cult.
Sure.
this morning they were in the Times Square subway station, because I'm doing the show here from the New York Bureau at the corner of Crack House and Porn Shop. They were giving out pamphlets for Jews for Jesus today in the Times Square subway station.
Hmm.
I love Jews for Jesus. They're my favorite religious group since Vegetarians for Meat. I recommend them highly. Eric Bollert is a regular on this show. And for those of you who don't know anything about Media Matters, if you just watch O'Reilly and hear him talk about how it's the end of the world and that a foreign-born billionaire is controlling the political process through media on Fox News, meaning George Soros, aside from the hilarious irony, you're missing some of the best journalism out there on the web. And Eric Bollert is a true friend to people who care about the truth and care about the future of this country, and I'm proud to welcome him to the show. Good morning, sir.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Of course. It's a pleasure to have you on. I have so many questions for you, but before I begin, because I've always wanted to interview you just on my own. Normally I sit in the corner when Steph talks to you and be a good little supplicant and do my Boo Radley impression, but I want to talk to you about what you do at Media Matters for the listeners who aren't hip to the site yet. And I want to ask you about Mr. Soros as well and the work you do as his evil army of the night. But first off, Eric, you've got some great pieces on Rupert Murdoch, and I want to ask you, what's the latest going on as of this morning?
Well, the latest is it all continues to fall apart. I mean, over the weekend, Rebecca Brooks was arrested, the head of the Scotland Yard resigned regarding allegations that their investigators turned a blind eye to Murdoch's minions who were writing checks apparently to police. Murdoch has to testify. Murdoch, Rupert, his son, and I guess Rebecca Brooks are going to. Rebecca Brooks is still going to testify even though she was arrested over the weekend before Parliament tomorrow, which is going to be, I think, a fiasco. Rupert Murdoch, by rule, is an awful hearing witness, and that's when the questions are mostly friendly. Incoherent, doesn't follow along, complete denial about what's going on.
But so he smiles a lot. He'll smile the whole time.
Maybe. I don't know if he's going to manage any tomorrow. And the questions are, and the questions and the tone from Parliament is going to be unlike anything he's ever had to face. Because what's so fascinating besides the criminal investigation is what's going on in Britain, and that Murdoch had built, it's such a relatively small company, and he owns so many media properties, he has so much power, he was able to create this wall of fear, very few politicians ever went after him or questioned him. He could elect prime minister, he could ruin careers, he could humiliate people with his scummy tabloids, and now that fear has faded away.
But Eric, that's my question.
I think
think you're going to see a lot of people holding back. I think you're going to see right from the prime minister himself. I think David Cameron has held back from being too fierce in his criticism. And I think that you're going to see a lot of folks afraid that Murdoch will weather this storm and they don't want to deal with the payback when his media empire comes gunning for them a year from now. I certainly think that's the case in the States so far.
In the States, I think you're right. But I think in Britain it's going to be brutal. Certainly the Labour leaders are going to be brutal. Cameron is in a real pickle because he incredibly hired, you know, Andy Coulson as his number one media person after he had resigned because of this hacking story. But that was the cavalier attitude. That was the arrogance. 2007, 8, 9, even through 2010. You know, we don't care about this story. Yes, it looks like we're guilty of sin, but no one can touch us. We are in control of the press. We're in control of politics, and apparently they're in control of portions of Scotland Yard. So the cavalier attitude, promote people who were responsible for the hacking, and now it's all coming back, and it's all... you know, he really is in Richard Nixon free fall. There's no way Murdoch can change the dynamics of the story.
Well, but the difference is that Nixon eventually had to be kicked out by his own party. I don't see Murdoch being kicked out by his own shareholders. I see him throwing a lot of people off the bus, perhaps his own son, or throwing people under the bus, rather. And I don't see this really hurting the empire, at least from the American point of view. I mean, we hear a lot about rumors that 9/11 victims' phones may have been hacked, but there's nothing deeper than that, is there?
Yeah, right. No, that's what the FBI is investigating. And if there was any truth to that, everything changes.
Well, let's talk about our American friends, because Andrew Breitbart, of course, is very near and dear to your heart and my heart as well. I recently got my first ever public FU from Andrew on Twitter, and it's like a laurel wreath. And, of course, there's the lovely Dana Lash and her Sublime fans. What kind of response have you heard from these people, from the right-wing media in America over the Murdoch scandal? Are they talking about it at all?
Well, that's what's fascinating, is that no. I mean, doesn't exist. You know, Rupert Murdoch is as I've mentioned before, he is the godfather of right-wing media in America, not just conservative press, but sort of hateful, fabricating, right-wing, gotcha, slimy press.
Right.
He has spent more money and propped up more publications and made more careers doing that. So his model, I mean, obviously Fox News is the ultimate model, but that sort of really dishonest attempt at journalism now permeates the right-wing media, and they don't know what to do because they can't blame the New York Times, they can't blame NBC. This is all Murdoch's fault, so they can't whine, they can't play the victim.
They are out of
their element because they don't have their natural knee-jerk reaction response.
We've already seen Steve Doocy, star of the Fox Morning Show, Doocy and Doocier, coming out and saying that the media is doing this to pick on him because aren't there better things to report, like what Casey Anthony had for breakfast? And so
you're already
seeing them trying to play victim in the States.
Yeah, that has just really begun. James Pinkerton on Fox News Watch over the weekend said any investigation into News Corp would mean a partisan Department of Justice.
Oh.
And how about this editorial in the Wall Street Journal today? This unsigned editorial, people have to go read it immediately. It is out of this world.
I haven't seen it. What is it?
It's this petulant, tin-eared, whiny, thrash. I mean, it's like Murdoch dictated it at like 2 in the morning Saturday night.
Oh, wow.
It's by the editorial staff of the Journal?
Yeah, unsigned. It is insane.
And what is it? Is it just painting them as a victim?
Oh, it's, I mean, lashing out at their critics, sort of defending buying stories in Britain. How dare anyone question the almighty authority of the Wall Street Journal? The Wall Street Journal would be out of business if Rupert Murdoch hadn't bought it. We are such a great newspaper now. Of course, since Murdoch bought the Journal, they haven't won a single Pulitzer Prize. They used to win about 3 every year before he bought the paper. Lashing out at the Bancroft family who sold it to them, lashing out at the New York Times. It's really an amazing read.
Wow.
And really, basically, and defending Les Hinton, who had to resign as the publisher last Friday,
basically
saying, how dare anyone question Les Hinton? We worked with Les Hinton. He's a good guy.
I mean,
that's sort of the level of the logic, but it's really just a piece of work. And people
it's going to be really fascinating.
Humiliated.
Yeah, it's going to be amazing to see how this story is going to play itself out, especially after he dropped his bid to buy B-Sky B in the UK last week. I wanted to pay Gene Wilder to call Rupert Murdoch in his Willy Wonka voice and say, "You get nothing! You lose! Good day, sir!" I want to ask you briefly about Media Matters for America, because it's a site a lot of people hear about, and I love how Bill O'Reilly is so devoted to giving you guys free advertising time. And I love the work you do, Eric, watching all this right-wing media. I don't know if you need to bleach your brain and eyeballs on a daily basis. But for the folks who don't know, how did Media Matters for America come about?
Yeah, it started in way back in 2004, which seems forever ago. And David Brock, who had been, you know, a partisan fighter on the right, a lot of people...
He helped bring about the Clinton impeachment.
Yeah, you know, wrote nasty things about the Clintons, American Spectators. I mean, that story is very well known, and now he came around to see the light, apologized to the Clintons. And he, having been in that right-wing machine, he saw where the holes were on the left, and he saw with the, you know, the advancement of the internet and what was taking place online, that there needed to be, there was lots of missing institutions, but one of them was a media watchdog. There were some smaller ones that did a good job, but one that had real money and staff and would monitor what Rush Limbaugh said and what was going on Fox. Because before that, I mean, Limbaugh on the radio, I mean, all that stuff just goes out into the ether. No one could record 3 hours of radio every day and transcribe it and hold him
accountable for the things he said.
So what, you know, he would say these insanely hateful things, and again, it would just sort of go into the ether. And now it's, you know, now there's a permanent record. Nobody, I don't think, at Media Matters could have known in 2004 how crazy Fox News would become 7 or 8 years later, but we obviously were keeping a very close eye on them. So, you know, we post videos, we post transcripts, we post blogs, and just sort of pointing out, you know, fact-checking problems. And also, one of the initial ideas was not only to monitor the right-wing media, but to keep an eye on the mainstream press and make sure they don't pick up these phony stories on the right.
Well, I got to say, Bill O'Reilly constantly promotes you guys against his own better judgment by complaining about how, you know, how dare they hold us accountable for our lies on this channel. You know, it's that's pretty much what you do. You're there to keep them honest, and you know, you editorialize a lot, but you're there to point out all the factual inaccuracies. And I can understand you might have carpal tunnel in your hands by now.
And you post the audio and video in context. You take a whole chunk before and a whole chunk after.
Yeah, O'Reilly's favorite defense is, you know, we take stuff out of context, and I always say, go to Media Matters. It's just drowning in context.
It is.
Paragraph after paragraph after paragraph. I mean, when we put clips up, you know, there's an interesting 15-second quote. We'll put up, like, the 4-minute clip.
You do.
So it's not just the 15 seconds. Everyone can see what goes before and after. And,
I'm sure Andrew Breitbart respects you posting entire clips in their full context. really, really quick, what's your relationship with Mr. Soros? Do you know him? Do you hang out with him? Does he smell nice?
I've never met him. You know, that's been a talking point for years. Years, you know, Soros were puppets, and he pays the whole, you know, everyone's salary. I think he gave $1 million within the last 12 months, and that was his first donation ever.
Right.
Yeah, I love that people get furious when a foreign-born billionaire uses his money to help people as opposed to one who helps billionaires.
Yes.
Eric Bowler, thank you for the work you do. Keep your soul clean. Don't get into too many ugly fights with those people, and if you get any hate on you, wipe it off soon so it doesn't stick, okay?
All right, talk to you.
Follow the man on Twitter. He's fighting for you every day, kids. Eric Bowler, MediaMatters.com. I'm John Fugelsang. It's the Stephanie Miller Show with Chris and Jim. We'll be right back after this.
It's fun for ages 8 to 80. Join us.
It's the Stephanie Miller Show. Stephanie Miller.
It's the Stephanie Miller Show. This is John Fugelsang coming to you from Steph East in New York City and lovely, fragrant Times Square, joined by Jim Ward and Chris Lavoie in the L.A. Bureau. Howdy. Good morning, gentlemen.
Hiya!
I want to tell you guys we had a great, great show for the Stephanie Miller Sexy Liberal Live Tour this weekend with Steph, myself, and Hal Sparks in Boston. What a crowd. I love Boston because I love it. Well, first off, because Michelle Bachmann told me that's where Washington crossed the Delaware to free the slaves.
Yes, sure.
But even more so because it's always a pleasure to be back in the state where Mitt Romney was pro-choice.
Yes, exactly.
How wonderful. That guy is flipped like a crack house mattress, I got to tell you. And it's great to be able to go into Boston and blame the people of the state firsthand for unleashing Mitt Romney on the rest of us.
Yeah, yeah.
Woof, woof. Go let the dogs out.
Oh, my. If I could be that stiff, I'd work in gay porn. I
now, is he originally from Massachusetts? Because he has no kind of, you know, Boston accent at all or anything.
No, I think he's an interloper as well.
Yeah.
But, you know, now that it looks like Rick Perry will most likely be jumping into the Republican presidential campaign, we're going to see some real competition for Mitt.
I won't be president of a country I don't believe in.
In fact, the people on Fox and Friends Sunday talked about that yesterday. Here, let's take a listen.
It looks
please.
Perfect for someone like Rick Perry to get in and maybe galvanize. Hey, there's 29 Republican governors in this country. Only 3 have endorsed any candidate in this race, so it's very wide open. But you mentioned the fundraising. Can he get in and raise money with Mitt Romney? I don't know.
There are a lot of Republicans who think he can't.
Well, the Christian Coalition, I think he could get a lot of money from that based on because Romney, obviously not being a Christian. Rick Perry, he's always on talk shows, Christian talk shows. He has days of prayer in Texas.
Next month in Houston at Reliant Stadium.
That's right.
Prayer.
And Tony Perkins, the Family Research Council president,
very well known in the Christian community.
He is endorsing him or saying that he hopes that he gets.
Oh, well, if Tony Perkins likes him, he must be a good Christian. Yeah. Let's break this down. First off, I think that Rick Perry's my favorite Christian who may have sent an innocent man to his death. There's nothing I like more than people who brag about being good Christian governors and love the death penalty, because as Jesus said, folks, forgive us our trespasses as we lethally inject those who trespass against us. But first off, we know that Rick Perry, is a Christian, but to hear on Fox them saying that Mitt Romney's not a Christian. I mean,
that's amazing.
That's like saying he's from Kenya, okay?
Who knew I was a Jew?
He's not a Christian because he's a Mormon. He's not a Christian, and I love defending Mormons, but I'll do it because it's so outrageous what they'll do. And again, I feel bad for Republicans because they just had a presidential campaign in 2008 where they all had to pretend they liked John McCain for a year. I know how hard that was for some of them. When these guys go at each other's throats, watching, Eric Cantor trying to get John Boehner's job, it's just so ugly. I would drink, too, if I was John Boehner.
I would give him a shift if I knew what one was.
And if you heard that clip, she made the comment that Romney's not a Christian, and there are two other people there sitting on the couch, and they said absolutely nothing. Right. They did not correct her.
Meanwhile, of course, if Romney's the nominee a year from now, they'll be supporting him and saying they've always supported him and they've always loved him, and Oceania's always been at war with East Asia. I mean, that's going to be their whole rap. They can't stand Mitt Romney, kids. They can't stand him. And we saw what happened in 2008. I mean, they had given this thing away, to anyone but McCain. The GOP did not want McCain to be the nominee. Rush Limbaugh, you could listen to him talking about how McCain was a rhino. And then McCain goes ahead and wins New Hampshire, like Mitt Romney will do in 2012, and they're forced to support him. If Rick Perry jumps in the race, he's got to deal with a lot of things. First off, the fact that he hasn't been a great governor for Texas. There are multiple gay rumors about... We can talk about that, right?
Yeah.
I don't want to spread gay rumors. I will say that I think if he was gay... The hair and the suits would be better, right, guys?
Yeah.
I mean, come on.
Well, yeah. Yeah, he'd have a Marcus Bachmann-type quality to him.
Exactly. Ooh, Marcus Bachmann, you're a barbarian, and I'm going to suck the gay out of you.
We have to understand, barbarians need to be educated. They need to be disciplined.
Ugh. Yes. Oh, and you know when I call you a barbarian, I don't mean this as an insult. I'm going to drive the gay out of you. Come unto me. Come unto me.
Oh, boy.
And this lady's got the best chance of being vice president of anybody, or at least the vice presidential nominee, because I do think Michelle Bachmann, unless she sticks her foot in her mouth, which is very, very likely, you kids know what I'm talking about, it looks very good for her to win Iowa. But I think Mitt Romney has got New Hampshire so sewn up. If you don't believe me, go back and watch the Republican presidential debate from last month, where even Tim Pawlenty was too afraid to criticize Mitt Romney in front of a New Hampshire crowd.
Yeah, that was wild.
Yeah, it shouldn't gonna be.
Shouldn't be. Should have you? I lost my train of thought. I'm talking about Rick Perry. I mean, if you expressed the desire to secede from the United States, shouldn't that preclude you from being ever becoming president
of those United States?
Well, exactly, and I feel the same way about the Confederate flag. Now, I'm half Southern. I love my Confederate friends and family. I love everyone, but to me, I've always been embarrassed of the Confederate flag. How do you call yourself a patriot while displaying a symbol of saying, yeah, I want to quit America to keep people as pets? And they'll say, hey, it's states' rights, states' rights. Yeah, the right to keep people as pets. That's what it was about.
Yeah.
And when Rick Perry stood on that stage and said that Texas joined the Union with the knowing we had the option to leave whenever we wanted, there's nothing more un-American than quitting America to start your own country, okay? I don't like the phrase un-American because I think it's fascist talk. You only fascist countries have that kind of you've never heard, hey, that's very un-Belgian of you.
Yeah.
Oh, Jorge, that's very un-Mexican. Ooh, it's very un-Canadian of you. But these things are sayings. They're very un-German. That sounds right.
Yeah.
So it's going to be pile on the Republicans for the rest of the hour, rest of the show, rather. We're here till 12 noon and Eastern time. 9 a.m. Pacific time.
That's right.
The number is 1-800-STEPH12. I'm John Fugelsang, filling in for the Stephanie Miller Lee Live Experience, and we're going to have Charlie Pierce of the Boston Globe when we come back. Don't go away.
Stephanie Miller.
Comedy's freshest female voice. Take that, Courtney Thorne Smith.
It's bizarre every time. It's the Stephanie Miller Show.
I've met Courtney
I am
Thorne
your
Smith.
Female voice this morning. I'm John Fugelsang, filling in for Steph, who's recovering from her Chardonnay-soaked weekend in Boston.
That's right.
With the Stephanie Miller Sexy Live Liberal Comedy Tour, whatever we're calling it these days. What a crowd. What a room. And what a show today. We've already had some great, great guests, but I'm very excited for the next one because he was at our gig in Boston the other night. My friends, sometimes you got guys who are writers for the Boston Globe or writers for Sports Illustrated or writers for Esquire or the New York Times. This guy's done it all. Do we have some music for Charlie Pierce?
There's only one man now that understands, and that's the author of Idiot America. Charlie Pierce, the funniest writer in the world, from the Boston Globe.
Why is everybody always laughing with me?
And the only wait, don't tell me panelist who
That's
is at
true.
The show.
That is correct. Good morning, Charlie Pierce.
Hello, gentlemen. Hey, John. Hey, by the way, guys, Fugel saying rock the place.
Oh, he always does.
He'll never tell you that himself, but he did.
He always does.
Do you
Thank
know, by
you.
The way, that, John, we didn't talk about this. Do you know we were at that show a mere three blocks from where Chris Lavoie used to work in high school?
I had no idea.
Yeah.
Where do we go? Is that a street corner or was that somewhere else?
Strawberry's Records in Downtown Crossing.
Right across from what used to be Filene's basement.
Yes.
And Strawberry
yes.
Records is not there anymore, and Filene's is not there anymore, and Chris is not there anymore.
Yeah, exactly.
Are there any record stores?
Wicked pizza.
Are there any record stores in Boston anymore?
Tower is gone, too, isn't it?
Oh, Tower's gone. Long gone.
Yeah. I believe it's Best Buy or Cheapo's in Central Square in Cambridge, and that's it.
Oh.
And Best Buy is downsizing, too. They're
yeah, whoever thought talking about going to a record store would make you an old fogey?
Right.
I mean, like, what's that? Oh,
well, the worst time was when my son was about 13. We had him, because we needed to give him some busy work, we had him alphabetize our albums. And he opened one of my old Wishbone Ash albums, and feet fell out. That was very hard to explain. But you get an indication, number one, when the last time I listened to that album was.
It's cute you made your son do. I used to make my really stoned friends alphabetize all my albums, and it would take for hours and days.
We realized the horrible revelation that between my wife and I, we own every album that Iron Butterfly made.
Wow.
And they made four.
Four?
So they made
really?
Four.
Well, normally, Charlie, that would end a marriage.
They made Heavy, Ball, Inagata De Vita, and Live.
Wow.
Live,
well,
by the way, contains the 48-minute version of Inagata De Vita.
Wow.
Oh,
God.
Wow.
They're playing that at Gitmo right now, and people are naming names.
And they're breaking people with it.
Yeah, you're lucky to have a wife, a codependency relationship with someone as twisted as you. It was great to see you. I got to tell you guys.
Good.
This guy is such a legend in Boston. After every show for the Stephanie Miller Sexy Liberal Comedy Tour, we have a meet and greet for the VIP folks who shell out the big bucks to get to feel up Hal Sparks and Stephanie. And I get the damaged Catholics who come to me. And we're sitting there doing our meet and greet, meeting all these wonderful people from Boston, these great audience members who are smart and sexy and cool. But Charlie Pierce shows up And it's like a rock star came into the room. They are like, Charlie Pierce is here? People were so thrilled. And a lot of them don't know what you look like. So as soon as they knew it was you, they were really ecstatic. And it was such a riot to see, you know, in this age when people are talking about the end of print media, to see what a superstar you were to the people of Boston for your wonderful columns you do.
Well, I appreciate that. Thanks. I do appreciate that. You were talking to Bullard earlier. My confession is I took a Murdoch paycheck for 7 years. I was a sports columnist in the Boston Herald.
That's right.
I was one of the first people they hired when they bought the thing in 1983. And my managing editor was a wall-eyed gentleman named Les Hinton.
Really?
Yeah, who's having a very bad, awful week right now.
Yeah, maybe you can give him a job sometime.
Because the bodies are going overboard in the Good Ship News Corporation like no place I've ever seen.
Plus, well, let me ask you about that. It looks like Uncle Rupert's really going to throw people under the bus, and he's going to survive this. He's going to weather the storm, but he's going to lose a lot of his henchmen. I mean, do you think that this is ever going to stick to Rupert?
No, I think it's stuck to him, but I don't know what's going to happen. If I had to guess, I would say that the eventual upshot is that Elizabeth, his daughter from Marriage Number One, will wind up running the company. She'll come in as the White Knight. A long time ago, I talked for purposes of a story I was doing for GQ about when Fox Television got into sports for the first time when they got their NFL contract. Mm-hmm. Everybody I talked to in the Murdoch Empire said Elizabeth was the sharp one of the kids.
Wow.
James and Lockwell.
She was like the Jeb of the Murdoch clan?
Yeah, but the problem is the Aussies didn't want to work for Sheila.
So she was never going
to get the top job. Now it looks like James is going to the clink. And Lachlan's not, everybody in the company knows Lachlan's not up to it.
Do you really think that James is going to jail? Do you think that would ever happen?
I think James is going to go to whatever they have for a minimum security prison in Britain. I think he's in huge trouble.
I think so too. He's the next shoe to drop.
I think Rebecca Brooks is going to give up the store.
Do you really?
I don't think they busted her over the weekend for nothing. I think they know what she has.
I don't know. I kind of think that these people know that Rupert Murdoch is more powerful than any politician, and that if they keep their mouths shut and toe the line, that there'll be a great golden parachute waiting for them when they come out of their minimum sentence. I really think that you're going to see a lot of politicians really afraid to pile on the guy to have Lee because they're afraid he's going to win this and eventually destroy them all.
I'm not entirely sure I'm reasonably sure that might be the case here. Over in Britain, you've got a lot of pent-up anger at the way he's done. I mean, his newspapers in America, the New York Post, you know, Fox News, we all know what they are. In Britain, there are
No, we don't all know what they are, Charlie. That's the problem.
There were a lot of influential people in Great Britain who are really ticked.
Imagine how tacky the New York Post is, and imagine 20 times tackier, and that's what's all over Britain.
I mean, the head of Scotland Yard just quit over this.
Yeah.
This is running much deeper through the institutions of British society than I think it probably does here.
I'm not going to say that definitively
about here either, by the way.
I think a lot of Brits are old enough to remember classy journalism. And, you know, one thing you can say about Rupert Murdoch, it's not exactly family values what his work is in print. And I think you have a lot of people who, aside from having personal grudges against the guy for the careers he's destroyed, have real cultural grudges against him for what he's done to journalism.
They're mad as a cut snake.
We referred to him at the Herald back in the day as an Aussie TNA merchant, and we did it with great affection and love because he kept our newspaper alive. But let's not have any illusions about what this guy's about. He's about power, and the way he gains it is by, you know, degrading a profession.
Yeah, no, he...
That's been the modus operandi everywhere he went, and that's why I have no patience with the Bancroft family, by the way.
Why is that?
I mean, because they knew. I mean, come on. I mean, when you sell it to Rupert Murdoch, you don't know what he's going to do to the property.
It's true. I will say
it's like selling your chapel to Bob Buccioni.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not still going to be a chapel in a year.
Yeah.
It's true. You know, I grew up on Long Island, and our paper there was Newsday. And Newsday, for better or worse, is a liberal paper. You know, to some degree, whatever, that's always a shifting definition. But I always thought, in a free society, you want to have the most liberal media possible. And by liberal, I don't mean pro-Democratic Party. I don't mean apologizing for the Democrats. And I don't even mean taking on liberal causes. I mean... the most liberal party, one that's devoted to questioning authority and looking out for the common good of all the people and trying to bring social progress about through journalism. That's what liberal media is to me.
Ironically, that's what the New York Post was before Rupert bought it. When Dorothy Shipp was running the New York Post, that's what it was.
Yeah.
It was the wild-eyed liberal tabloid in New York.
Yeah.
And it was founded by Alexander Hamilton, who kind of had a fetish for national debt, if you know what I'm talking about. So that's even more irony.
He loved the national debt, but he also had a fetish for alien and sedition acts, too, so we're not really...
Well, so did Lincoln. We could geek out and drive the audience away all day about that.
Lincoln had a really great army about 30 yards from the White House.
I know. Hey, listen,
Hamilton had a bunch of drunks in western Pennsylvania.
Look, if I had a wife like Lincoln had, I'd want to hang people for no reason as well. So, I mean, I totally get it.
Apparently Mrs. Hamilton was really hot, or at least the several Mrs. Hamiltons were.
As far as hot went back then.
Yeah, and then too bad it got him killed.
Don't fight, you can't win, basically. You know, that's
right on.
My feeling about Alexander Hamilton and the Civil War.
Welcome to History Gossip on the radio. A couple of years ago, Rupert Murdoch described himself in a TV interview as a liberal, saying he considered himself to be a liberal, and then he donated a lot of money to Hillary Clinton. Are you getting out of the car, Charlie? Is that what I'm listening to?
I'm actually in a car. I'm sorry. I seem to have parked over plutonium. Don't worry.
Okay, yeah, I was going to say. I didn't know if it was that or your pacemaker was going off.
I'm going through the nuclear power plant drive-through window.
Oh, okay, fantastic.
For a cup of plutonium. The legend is he had a picture of Lenin in his room when he was in college and stuff.
That's not being a liberal. That's being a douche. Like, he says he's a liberal. I mean, you know, when I think liberal, I think FDR, I think JFK, I think Martin Luther King, I think Jesus, okay? I don't see how he can push the agenda he has and still call himself a liberal, but I was curious as to what psychologically or from a business model would make Murdoch want to announce he was a liberal.
Because, I mean, he wanted to justify his the money he gave to Hillary. And the reason he gave the money to Hillary was the fact that the one ideology he has consistently is power and influence.
Right.
And on the odd chance that Hillary Clinton would be president of the United States, he gave her a bunch of money.
Yeah, exactly right.
It's not like the guy has a conscience.
Well, exactly.
And I think conservatives should realize that, too, by the way.
I wonder how...
If the tide ran the other way, Fox News... Yeah, I mean, Gretchen Carlson would be writing for The Nation right now.
Yeah,
well, exactly.
I'm not kidding.
Yeah. No, I think you're right. And again, it's all about what makes money. You'll never go broke telling people who've been wrong about everything on the right, wrong about Clinton's budget, wrong about the impeachment, wrong about invading Iraq, wrong about Bushonomics. You'll never go broke telling people who've been wrong for 20 years, hey, you've been right all along. And that's Fox News's message.
Not just that, but I mean, this is one that came up over the weekend. We have this neighborhood festival near where I live in Newton, and Barney Frank was there. And I was talking with him, and we had talked when I wrote Idiot America. There's a chapter in Idiot America about the people.
That's Charlie's book, Idiot America, which everybody should buy.
Who worked in the hospice where Terry Schiavo died. Mm-hmm. And I talked to Barney prior to going down there to do that research, and he said he was in the Congress talking to Republican representatives going, look, not only are you being incredibly indecent to this family, you're killing yourself politically. Stop doing this. And he couldn't stop them. And he said, the budget crisis right now is Terry Schiavo on steroids. They know what they're doing and they can't stop themselves.
Hmm. Well, yeah, and they don't want the economy to get better, because if the economy gets better, they lose. So that's what we're looking at.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Go ahead. No, please. Wrap it up.
No, okay. And,
yeah.
And, I mean,
that's
I
how
really
we do it here.
I mean, you get me, Stoy, we roll in Brooklyn, man. None of this Southern California stuff.
Exactly right. You in the East Coast now.
Anyway.
What's going to happen, Charlie?
I think they're going to get some jury-rigged, miserable, terrible bargain out of things where there'll be severe there'll be cuts that really hurt people on the chance that they'll get some tax relief, that there'll be some tax reform and some tax justice, you know, 15 years down the line. I mean, the president said something utterly amazing this weekend that I can't remember where I said was. He said, we have to get our fiscal house in order so the next time we propose a big spending program, people won't scream big government, big government, big government. I'd like to know what president of what country this guy thinks he is.
Exactly.
There's no way you're gonna propose a major spending program and not have the howler monkeys, you know, flinging poo.
Exactly. And let's never forget Ronald Reagan grew the government by 61,000 jobs. Tell a Republican that fact today. Charlie Pierce, I'm such a fan. It was a pleasure to meet you at the show the other night. Everyone read Charlie's work. I'm John Fugelsang. We got lots more show coming up. Edie McClurg's joining us at the top of the hour. We're taking your calls at 1-800-STEF-12, and we'll be right back.
Public indecency? We weren't really doing it. We were just acting.
It's the Stephanie Miller Show.
Stephanie Miller.
That's not my name. That's not my name.
It's not my name. I'm John Fugelsang, filling in for Stephanie on the Stephanie Miller Show, joined by Jim Ward and Chris Lavoie from the West Coast Bureau.
Yes.
I'm joining you from New York City, where every time the heat hits 90 degrees, it magically activates every individual block stench of stale urine.
Yeah. It's been hot there, hasn't it?
Oh, it's been hot. We drove back from Boston yesterday from the big comedy show we did. And it was 91 degrees, like in Connecticut, just at like 11 o'clock in the morning. It's disgusting.
Ew. Yikes.
So what a great time to be indoors talking with you guys.
It was beautiful here this weekend.
I don't want to hear it. We were in Tucson with the tour last week.
Yeah.
And Tucson's like Florida. It's a place where people move for the climate and then stay indoors with AC all day to avoid the climate.
Right.
One cool thing we had in New York for the music fans, Paul McCartney played Yankee Stadium the other night for the first time ever. And what a set list Paul gave us. Just for the Beatles fans, really quick. This guy threw in stuff he's never done live before. He opened with Hello Goodbye. He did Junior's Farm from Wings.
Mm-hmm.
He sang The Night Before, the Beatles, you know, the Beatles song, one of their earliest songs.
Mm-hmm.
He did I've Just Seen a Face, I
Treat
Will, Blackbird.
The night before.
Yeah, 1985 from Wings. I'm looking at the set list right now. My God, it's like the guy's 69 years old. He keeps pushing himself creatively. He does a 3-hour concert. It just makes me want to never eat meat or cheese again. So,
I bet he didn't do Revolution Number 9.
He did not. No, he did not do Revolution Number 9. One band has done that in history, and it was Phish. Because Phish in the 90s was having a contest. They were playing at college, and they said, we'll play a whole album in its entirety. And the college kids all voted on the White Album. So Phish played the White Album,
oh my God,
including Revolution Number 9, in their entirety. There is a bootleg of that somewhere. It is, shall we say, raw. But I love Paul, and I've worked with Paul McCartney a couple times in the past when I was in a previous
interviewed
life.
Him and saw him on the telly.
Indeed. And
back
and,
when you
know,
were a VJ, you worked
when
with
I was
him.
A VJ. I got to work with Paul a couple times. I worked with George. I interviewed Yoko, and I handed Ringo a glass of water, and he said, thanks.
So, and George was the last Beatle to have a number one hit.
George was the last Beatle to have a number one album and a number one hit.
Yep.
And it was 24 years ago this year with Got My Mind Set on You.
That's right.
Wow. Although McCartney will spend the rest of his life trying to make sure he's the last one.
Yeah.
And I like that. I like that he's still competing with George and John even though they're gone. I think it keeps him sharp, and I think McCartney's last album was the best he ever did. And that's been your Classic Rock Minute. Thank you. I can't do this with Hal Sparks. I come on the show when Hal's hosting, and all I can talk about is metal bands I never heard of the whole time. So, and we had a big debate last time, two Fridays ago, because Hal came down saying he didn't think the Beatles were that significant, and I had to, smack
really?
A bitch.
Oh,
yeah,
wow.
I had to smack a bitch over that. So,
yeah.
And I want to thank all the listeners for calling up, because I said, you know what, if you don't like, if there's no Helter Skelter, none of the crappy metal music you like would ever exist.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how we school them. So,
yeah, that's true.
That's your Beatle moment, and there'll be more of that coming. I want to take some calls from some listeners. And Mike from Rhode Island's been waiting a long time to talk about the debt ceiling. Are you there, Mike? Good morning.
Yes, I am. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I was at the show on Saturday, and it was big, gargantuan fun, and thank you so much.
Oh, thank you. What a great audience we had there.
It was lovely.
In Spokane, and you were in Boston over the weekend?
No, he's in Rhode Island.
Yeah, we drove up.
Yeah.
I had the wrong thing. I'm sorry. Well, great. Well, I'm glad you liked it. Wasn't Stephanie hilarious?
Yeah. Although I actually thought that Hal was the sleeper. His monkey dance was just gut-splitting.
Yes, I'm one of the biggest Hal Sparks groupies you'll ever meet. It's a pleasure to work with those two funny people.
Yeah, you're a lucky man.
Well, thank you, Ed.
You said that I wanted to that got me thinking, and that's why I called up this morning.
Please.
I don't remember exactly what it was. It was something about the debt ceiling negotiations.
Okay.
And, you know, it was something along the lines of, why does Obama have to be the one to compromise? Because these guys are obvious loons and blah, 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 woof.
Well, that sounds like something I would say.
Yeah, the Republicans won't cave on tax increases because they're all, smoking the Grover Norquist hookah.
Mm-hmm.
But then there's another thing. And you know, at this point, Norquist is their brand.
Yeah,
you know,
I mean,
no taxes.
He's their St. Paul.
Because that's where we're drawing the line in the sand, because that's what we want to be identified with in the hearts of the voters.
Yeah, despite the fact that the majority of voters elected a guy who said he was going to raise taxes on the upper 2%, despite the fact that 80% of American people, that includes at least some Republicans' kids, support raising taxes on the upper 2%. Bill Clinton balanced a budget when he did it. Eisenhower had a surplus. Eisenhower was the last Republican president to ever have a surplus, and
right,
statistically taxes are lower now than they were under
want
Reagan.
Is the 50s over again, and what was the tax rate in the 50s? What was the top tax rate?
Exactly. 91%.
Yeah. 91%. Yep. And when these guys, and you're exactly right, Mike, when these guys talk about the 50s and the golden era of the 50s, why were the 50s so great? Because of what the combination of capitalism and what could be called socialist policies. In the 50s, they taxed the hell out of the rich. You had the GI Bill, and you had the Interstate Highway Program.
Mm-hmm. But the thing I wanted to tell you, I wanted to go all meta on you now and say that now that the Republicans say, we're going to hold out on the debt ceiling because, and Obama says, okay, I'm willing to compromise. What do you need? At this point now, compromise is Obama's brand, and now the Republicans, like Charlie says, they know it's the Schiavo thing over again, and they can't do it because now to compromise gives Obama a win. That Obama is on record as being, all I want more than anything else in the world, more than keeping my promises, more than getting people out of Gitmo, more than, re-election even, is I want to compromise. And just for that reason now, the Republicans are culturally forbidden to give him that.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And that's
right.
What's really happening now. That's why they're in this Schiavo-like bunker.
Right. Okay, well, I thank you very much for the call,
Mike.
Okay,
one more thing, please.
Oh, okay.
There was another band that did Revolution Number 9.
Who?
They were called Kurt Hoffman's Band of Weeds. It was a 8 or 9 piece rock band. They used to play at the Knitting Factory a lot. I have a bootleg recording of that. It's pretty twisted.
Oh, man. Thanks. All right. Well, thank you.
Thanks,
I'd ask
Michael.
You to take that bootleg recording and bury it in a lead box somewhere.
Please.
We have to go to break right now, but we have plenty of calls coming up, including we got Bob, who's a Tea Partier, calling up to give the flip side of what we just heard. We're going to break now, Chris?
Yes.
Thank you, Obi-Wan. I'm Jeff Eaglesang. It's the Steph Miller
Show. And Edie McClurg joins us at the top of the hour.
Edie McClurg, yes. my idol. She's joining us at 11 a.m. It'll be lots of fun. We're taking your call still at 1-800-STEPH-12. I'm John Eaglesang. We'll be right back.
Ladies and gentlemen, it's the Stephanie Miller Show.
It's the Stephanie Miller Show, coming to you live today from both New York and Los Angeles. I'm John Eaglesang here in the disgustingly hot and humid and urine-stained nastiness of Times Square at the corner of Crack House and Porn Shop. And I'm joined in the West Coast Bureau, as always, by Mr. Chris Lavoie, the fabulous Emmy Award-winning Jim Ward,
hello,
and the usual guest on Mondays.
Sounds like somebody's got a case of the Mondays.
With McClurg.
Monday, Monday.
Motorheads, geeks, sluts, bloods, wastoids, dweebies, dickheads, they all adore it.
Edie McClurg.
Every time I hear that intro, I'm amazed that some of those words can be said on the radio. Good morning, Edie.
And that was a long time ago, too. So.
Yeah. What was that,
when
85,
was that?
86?
Oh, somewhere in the mid-80s,
yeah.
I'm thinking.
Oh, my.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, it's like I run out. I try to list off all of your credits, and it gets exhausting. I don't know where to begin. From Ferris Bueller's Day Off to Carrie to Planes, Trains, and Automobiles. I mean, my God.
Don't forget all the voiceover work, too.
I can't listen to the radio without hearing you. It's stunning.
And how about Natural Born Killers?
I loved that movie. And you got killed by Rodney Dangerfield.
Yeah,
yeah, wow. That film's aged really well. Do you have a
favorite?
No,
actually, it was the guy who was the lead character.
Woody Harrelson.
Woody Harrelson.
Yes, okay.
I actually saw that at the Biograph in Chicago.
Did you?
Yeah, and when I walked out of the theater, I thought somebody touched me on the shoulder. I would have decked him.
I was so rattled after seeing that movie.
That was Oliver Stone, mid-90s, directing a Quentin Tarantino script and pulling out all the stops. And that film was actually aged pretty well. It turned a whole generation of people onto Leonard Cohen music, too. And great
everybody
soundtrack.
Everybody knows.
Yeah, terrific film. Edie, do you have a favorite film credit from all your vast repertoire? Do you have a movie that meant the most to you or that you're the most proud of? It's not a hard question, Edie.
Wow.
Well,
come on now, spit it out. Do you have a favorite?
Well, there's, you know, do you have a favorite child? I mean,
yes, but it's not
I loved you in A River Runs Through It.
A River Runs Through It meant a lot to me.
Yeah.
Robert Redford chose me, and I'd gone in at the same time that Craig Sheffer was there, and he ended up being the lead. And I went in, and Robert Redford said, do you understand this family? Because I'd read the script, and I said, yes, I do understand this family. When my mother did not want to hear what was being discussed, mm-hmm. she would lift the hem of her apron and study the stitching.
Oh, wow. Wow.
And clear her throat like that. And you knew, get off the topic.
Huh.
Whatever it was embarrassed her.
Right.
And wow. Robert Redford turned to me and he said, my God, that's what my Uncle Jim was doing when he crossed his legs and brushed his pants as though there's lint on his pants. And I said, I was a little kid, and I said, why is Uncle Bill, you know, or Jim, rubbing his pants? There's nothing on his pants. And my mother grabbed me and shut me up real fast because those kinds of families that can't talk to one another.
Right, right. Yeah.
And he said, that's amazing. I had never thought about my Uncle Jim. Wow. Yeah. And he's the one that, you know.
That hired you.
Yeah.
Wow. At least I know now what to do if I ever read for Redford. Thank you for the tip. My dad wouldn't do that. If my dad didn't like the conversation, he would just start cleaning his Glock 9mm.
That shuts the conversation down pretty quick.
Yeah. I guess so.
The most remarkable thing about that movie was that Brad Pitt was actually doing a Robert Redford impersonation, which I didn't think was possible.
Well, yeah, I'll tell you why that was, is... Norman McLean, who wrote the book about his own life.
Right.
Many people tried to get the rights to that over and over many years, including Redford. And Bill Hurt actually went and got a full Orvis,
fly fishing
outfit and wanted to go fishing with Norman McLean, trying to talk him into, you know, give me the rights to be in this movie. And he said, no. And so it took Redford, I think, over 11 years to get Norman McLean to turn over the rights to make that film. And he died just as we were starting the film.
Oh, no.
Yeah. Mm. But his children and nieces and nephews, they're grown people, he put them in the train's arriving scene.
Right, okay.
So, you know, they came and saw what was, you know, a legacy.
Yeah, yeah.
Wow. You know, this is what happens when you hang out with Edie McClurg. We were at Stephanie's house last fall for her big coming out party, and I was hanging out with Charmy and with our friend Karen, and Edie shows up after her play ends around 11 o'clock, and we hang out like in Stephanie's front porch, and Edie is telling us stories about shooting Carrie with Sissy Spacek and with Brian De Palma till 1 in the morning, and it's like, you're the coolest lady I've ever met. I mean, my God.
Oh, no, not me. I'm dorky.
Oh, stop it. And you're my favorite kind of artist. You're an artist who cares about what's happening in this country.
Yep.
You know, Edie, people always say, why don't actors just shut up about their opinions, huh? And I don't think actors need to shut up and sing.
Yeah.
I don't think artists need to shut up about, and the people who say that have no problem with a NASCAR figure or an athlete or a country singer wants to spout off.
Right.
I don't think artists need to talk less. I think ordinary people need to talk about their opinions more in this country and be more politically engaged. And I think that artists are leaders in the society.
Mm-hmm.
And I love that you're someone who, you know, people see as being this, you know, lovely character actor who's been in all these wonderful films, but you're one of the sharpest minds I know in all of Hollywood. And I understand that, you know, you're pretty fired up about the debt ceiling as well.
Well, they are not understanding. If they don't increase the debt ceiling, there will be people who will not have money for food, who will not have money for prescription drugs that keep them alive. And these are things that are provided for, and we need the debt ceiling raised in order that these people are not going to die.
Yeah. Well, it's really, really
true. This is life and death.
And I got to tell you guys something, and some fans of Obama won't like this, but, you know, when Barack Obama was doing that Scott Pelley interview last week and said that, you know, when he said, are these checks going to go out or will Social Security checks go out? And Obama said, I can't guarantee the checks will go out if the Republicans won't make a deal with us. I think he made a mistake doing that. I think he scared people. My mom was terrified when she saw that interview because she thought, oh, my God, I'm not going to get my Social Security check. And I think that Obama, look, I know you're negotiating hard. You got to scare people. But I don't think he'll ever allow that to happen. But I think it was a mistake for him to say it was a possibility. If I was advising him, I'd say, you're going to get out there, President Obama, and you are going to say, I will not allow the Republican Party to keep your Social Security checks from coming. That you say. Don't say you're scared the checks won't come. Do you guys agree?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Although Stephanie probably wouldn't if she were
here. I know.
There.
Okay, so Stephanie will call in screaming at me for getting Republicans elected by saying that.
Right.
You know, this is the fight we have, Edie McClurg, all the time on this show with Stephanie. And one of the reasons I love this show.
Don't criticize you ever. Well, yeah. For any reason.
But this is why I love Stephanie, why I love this show. Because, you know, the Republican Party, we love our Republican friends, but we saw what happens when you have blind loyalty behind a leader. You know, after Bush's economy began messing up, after we knew there were no WMDs, after we knew the tax cuts for the rich weren't working, and after the Gitmo photos came out, Republicans still voted Bush back into office en masse. There was no dissent in the ranks. I love, and I'm not a Democrat, but I love that the Democratic Party can be a bloody hot mess and have this much dissent in the ranks, because we aren't allowed to debate.
Shut up.
This show, we debate it all the time. And you know what? It's like, the more I say, every time a liberal criticizes Obama, a moderate feels more safe about voting for him.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, so, you know,
but
I mean,
Stephanie would say, I think we should just support our president and be faithful in that.
Yes, and she'd use that accent, too.
Honestly, I think we should just trust our president in every decision that he makes, and we should just support that, you know, and be faithful in what happens.
Deep thinker Britney Spears.
Britney Spears from
Yeah,
that's
the
Bush.
One time Britney yeah. Spears wasn't lip-syncing, by the way, after that interview. My God.
So if nursing home bills are not going to be paid, are we just going to roll the old buzzards out onto the sidewalk and say, fend for yourself?
Oh, exactly. That's death panel logic. That's Obama's sinister endgame. He wants to bring it all down. In fact, we had Monica Crowley, America's sweetheart. I love Monica Crowley. I do. I am glad that there's someone there to, you know, bring the McLaughlin group dynamic into the 1950s.
Wrong!
She came out, let me try and find the actual email. She came out and wrote an op-ed, I believe for Andrew Breitbart, believe it or not.
Really?
Monica
you
Crowley
don't
said
say.
That, that
deuce
for,
you
big,
say.
For biggovernment.com, which I recommend biggovernment.com for those who don't believe in Satan, she said Obama is willing to starve seniors to death after that Scott Pelley interview. I think that when Obama did that, he gave the right all the ammo they needed to scare seniors about it. I know he was trying to scare seniors too, but look, folks,
for different
the
reasons.
Fact is the GOP hates government. They hate entitlements. They hate Social Security. They want to get rid of it, and they are not friends to America's seniors or people who plan on being seniors.
Wouldn't it be poetic justice if Grover Norquist drowned in a bathtub? I think that would be...
For those who don't get that reference, Grover Norquist said, I got it. Grover Norquist said he'd like to shrink government down to it was small enough that you could drown it in a bathtub and then do it. Now, every time you have a right-wing friend say government, and tell me if you agree, Edie, I say every time you have a right-wing friend who talks bad about government, replace government with we the people. Okay, because that's what we're talking about here. I don't believe in big government. I believe in good government. Ronald Reagan grew the government by 61,000 jobs when he was president.
There I go again.
And you know what? He did it because he created the Department of Veterans Affairs, which I think we would all agree is a very worthy thing to have in our government. Reagan grew the government. Clinton shrank it. Government is only as bad as the people who vote for it. And so if you're just wasting your life with Kardashians and not paying attention, you're going to have bad government. If you get engaged, care about a decent society, you'll have better government. And that's what I love about democracy. So vote for me.
And your running mate, Kim Kardashian.
Well, what do you think is going to happen, Edie? Do you think that the Republicans are going to you know, give on some of these tax increases?
Something has to happen because right now we have AT&T is a major corporate donor to the Tea Party.
Yeah.
This is very scary to me.
That's true. That is true. And you know, AT&T, my God, I don't want to say anything bad about them because my iPhone might work worse. pardon me if I drop out halfway through this broadcast. It is really the defining, I think, the defining political debate of the year. And so we do have, is Bob still on the line, Chris?
Yeah, Bob in Tennessee.
We have a bona fide Tea Party member calling in, and I'm always happy when Republicans call into the show because we don't like who Republicans vote for, but we love our Republican brothers and sisters. Bob, are you there?
Yeah, I'm a Tea Party member, which by definition means I'm not a Republican or a Democrat. I'm one rational player in this debate.
Okay, well, let me ask you a question here, because here's my feeling on the Tea Party. I think the Tea Party began, like, by the Ron Paul guys, people who were disgusted that George Bush was spending money like Courtney Love in Amsterdam, okay? But I think that your movement has become taken over by just garden variety nutjob right-wingers, and at least they seem to be setting the tone more. Is there really a Tea Party, or are you not just Republicans who will wind up voting Republican, but you're embarrassed about it?
No, that's a fallacy. The Tea Party was formed because of economic issues, and they will be sustained by economic issues. And that issue is that profligate government spending on these entitlement programs that represent over $100 trillion of unfunded debt, which is within our lifetime, the interest alone on this debt of these unsustainable programs, which are politically motivated, are going to consume the entire federal
budget. Wait, politically motivated?
Oh, obviously, because
why we're going to keep seniors alive? We're going to keep seniors alive so they'll vote for us.
Well, look at how they were created. We created a system or a model that's unsustainable. Was created by politicians in order to gain constituents. Like in the one case, elderly people that wanted medical care for free in an unsustainable program. It's like giving candy.
What do you mean for free? They do pay into this program. I wouldn't say it's quite for free. Would you agree?
Well, it's unsustainable. It loses money hand over fist.
All right. You know what? I'll tell you what, Bob. We have to go to break. I want to keep you on the line to come back and join us with Edie McClurg, because I want to talk to you about this and ask how many senior friends you have who agree with you. Will you stay on the line?
Yeah, he's
okay. It's the Stephanie Miller Show. I'm John Fugelsang. We'll be back in just a second. Don't go away.
What is this? What's going on?
It's the Stephanie Miller Show. Stephanie Miller.
My bell, these are words that go together well.
Stephanie Miller.
It's the Stephanie Miller Show. I'm John Fugelsang, filling in for Steph in New York City, along with the L.A. crew, Chris Lavoie, Jim Ward, and the luminous Edie McClurg.
And don't risk losing your important computer files. Get Carbonite Online Backup. Carbonite automatically backs up your files whenever you're connected to the Internet, and it couldn't be easier. Go to Carbonite.com today and enter Stephanie for a free trial plus 2 months free with any subscription. That's Carbonite.com. Offer code Stephanie.
Thank you, Chris. Hey. He's been frozen in Carbonite. This is a rare form of Tourette's that makes him shout out Carbonite promos randomly.
Yes,
so.
Exactly.
Thank you for doing that.
Hey, no problem.
Edie, it's great to have you here. How's it going so far?
Last night I was at the final show of the Outfest.
Cool.
And my young cousin, Angelique Cabral, was starring in the closing night film.
Wow.
So all the family gathered.
What's the name of the film?
The name of the film is A Perfect Family. Mm-hmm. And Kathleen Turner and Richard Chamberlain, Jason Ritter, Emily Deschanel. And my cousin plays her lover.
Nice.
And Kathleen Turner is running for Catholic Woman of the Year. And she has a gay daughter.
Oh, wow. Is it a comedy or is it a dramedy? Or...
Yes, okay. Both.
Okay,
uh-huh.
Very
yeah.
Cool.
Well, I think that's awesome. I talk a lot on this show. I come from an abnormally Catholic background.
You have a former nun and a former priest?
Yes, we used to have open casket reunions in my house. My dad was a Franciscan brother. He wore the brown Jedi robes and the rope belt.
Wow.
And my mom was a nun who spent many years in Africa working with lepers and in a hospital in the jungles of Malawi as a nurse. So we were very, very Catholic. And when I began breaking away from the Catholic Church and reading more about the Bible, I was stunned to realize that you can't use the Bible to justify any kind of homophobia at all. Jesus never said a thing about gay people. I would actually argue that he was very pro-gay. I can tell stories about that, but all of the homophobia comes from a bit in Deuteronomy that's really about male prostitution, a bit in Paul's letter to Romans that's really about idolatry and heterosexuals behaving badly, Sodom and Gomorrah, which is really about public gang rape of angels in the streets, and one line from Leviticus that is from a chapter that everyone ignores all the rules in it anyway. So I have no problem with being homophobic. It's America. It's your right. But you can't hide behind the Bible to do it. It doesn't work. And you can't call yourself a Christian if you're going to hate on your gay brothers and sisters.
Yep.
Wow, you know a lot, Fuba Fang.
Well, it comes from having no social life. And however, one thing I will respect about the Tea Party, and I want to get back to Bob in Tennessee here, who is a Tea Party member, is that the Tea Party isn't really known for its homophobia. They're more about economic issues. Am I right, Bob?
I would say so, but there's a lot of diversity in the Tea Party. But primarily, as I said, it was founded by motivated by economic issues, and its primary goal is economic solutions.
Exactly. Now, in this case, would you be willing to go to a senior citizen's home and say that you want to dismantle Social Security and Medicare?
Well, we're going to have to do that anyway within our lifetime, so the program's unsustainable.
What if we went back to an Eisenhower-era tax code or even a Clinton or Reagan-era tax code that would generate more revenue? Well, that would be a simple solution, right?
Yeah, that would be fine because we didn't have Medicare or Medicaid, and that's dominating the this $100 trillion in unfunded debt. Also, at that time, it would be unrealistic to go back there for a number of reasons. Number one, the United States was a dominant power in the world. We're the only one that wasn't destroyed during World War II. So
right.
We had our infrastructure intact. We had no competition. And, everybody owed us money.
And now, socialist programs like the GI Bill helped make America a great post-war economy, right?
Well, the GI Bill was just minuscule in cost compared to Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security.
Sure, but troops were paying into the GI Bill before they began.
Exactly. But like I said, it was probably a wasteful government program.
The GI Bill was a wasteful government program? Listen, corporate America thought they were getting boatloads of free labor coming back to the states who would work for peanuts. Thank God we had people in the White House, in this case Democrats, who cared about our returning troops and made sure they'd have a place at the table. And that music means we got to go to break. I'm John Fugelsang. It's the Stephanie Miller Show. We'll be defending more Democrat socialistic policies of the 50s and sex jokes when we come back.
Yeah.
Stephanie Miller.
She used to be a strong, smart, beautiful woman. Why did she transform herself into that baby hooker?
It's the Stephanie Miller Show. I'm John Fugelsang, filling in for Steph, along with Jim and Chris and Edie McClurg in the L.A. Bureau. This hour is brought to you by the Tea Party, outraged about government spending and deficits since January 21st, 2009. a little bit recent, their outrage, and I never heard the Tea Party being outraged about our tax dollars being stolen from us to finance an illegal war against Iraq, which had never attacked us.
Mm-hmm.
Getting really good comments on Twitter. If you don't follow me on Twitter, please do and give me validation in my life. Get Milton just wrote, yeah, the Tea Party is very diverse. They have members from Alabama, Mississippi, Texas, Oklahoma, Kansas. You know, diversity. And Grounded 77 writes on Twitter, what's with the Tea Party guy ribbing on unfunded debt and not including military operations?
Exactly.
Indeed, indeed. Edie, how do you handle these Tea Party people?
Roughly. Sandpaper.
I feel that they need succor and training and teaching.
And discipline.
Discipline. But the thing is that Michelle Bachmann is such a ringleader, and they want to defund the EPA.
Mm-hmm.
They want to take away funds for community health centers, the Head Start program, and they don't want anything to get to Planned Parenthood at all.
But Edie, Grandma won't mind eating cat food if a rich guy gets a tax cut. I mean, isn't it worth it to make billionaires? Haven't billionaires suffered enough? Can't Grandma eat some kennel ration for a couple of years so a guy can buy a yacht, a second yacht? Come on, Edie, where's your priorities?
Well, the yacht business is really hurting. We need to sell more yachts.
And this is how it works, kids. If you fight for the bottom 98% of the population, it's class warfare. If you fight for the top two, it's pro-growth. I want to take a call from Dave in Michigan, who's going to talk about our Tea Party caller we just had. Dave, are you there?
Hey, yes, I am. Well, I'd like to make a couple points. First thing, as far as the Tea Party being, he said he's not a Republican or a Democrat, but really every candidate that ran as a Republican. The Tea Party was jump-started by some very powerful super lobbyists, Tim Phillips, Dick Armey, all with, strong Republican ideology. And the thing, as far as their concern about the financial concerns about the debt and the deficit, it's a single focus, thought. You know, they want to focus on cutting the budget. Well, I'll give you an example of cutting government and cutting the budget. Look at Mexico. I'll give you another great example of where the tax codes were a little higher. If you don't want to use the 40-year track record of the late 40s, 50s, 60s, and 70s, go back to the Clinton model. The super wealthy paid a little bit more. There was revenue coming in. And the other big thing is we have more of a job problem than anything else. Think about how many billions of dollars were lost with people that don't get paid on Friday. And, there's no buying power.
Well, in fairness, too, the jobs thing is part of the Clinton model. It was Bill Clinton who, I would say, got elected because he was able to steal NAFTA from George Bush Sr. And, you know, NAFTA screwed a lot more young people over than NAMBLA ever could. I mean, that's where all the jobs went. I don't know why we don't hear...
No question about it. Didn't mean to interrupt you. There's no question it's the single biggest flaw of the Clinton years. But, of course, Clinton raised the taxes on the wealthy again, and it was, 38-40%. But if you go back to the 50s, 60s, and 70s, where they paid as high as 90%, and that's where this country was built. Infrastructure was built. Middle class was robust and thriving. Mexico's a great example. We can cut it right down to the Mexican government, and that's what you've got, a third-world country.
Exactly right. Dave, I thank you for the call. I do take issue with Dave's point that NAFTA was the biggest flaw of the Clinton years. I would say the derivatives trading and poor taste in groupies was the biggest flaw of the Clinton years. Is Mary here from Los Angeles?
Hello, Mary is here from Los Angeles.
Hey, Mary, good morning.
Good morning. I have a couple of points. One of my points is actually a matter of proper word usage and respecting language. I really take issue with saying our Republican friends. It denigrates the word friends. Friends do not screw each other over like this.
Okay.
Friends
okay.
do not stab each other in the back. Colleagues would be a fine word, or fellow citizens. That's great. Friends, I beg to differ.
Well, here's the thing. I'm not going to call them enemies, okay? And we are on the same side.
I'm not suggesting calling them enemies, but I do suggest saying colleagues or fellow citizens, because I think that's a little more accurate. That's still negative, but it does not denigrate the word friends. None of my
I'm hearing
friends
you. Okay.
are new to me.
I don't think it denigrates the word friends. I think it elevates the Republicans, because here's the thing. Every liberal has a conservative in their life that they love and care about, and every conservative has a liberal that they pretend to tolerate. And I think that if the liberals aren't the ones who are being upstanding, who are being the adults in the room, who are being the kind ones, then we've given up the mantle. And I don't want to let the conservatives ever have a chance to call us the bad guys.
I understand that. Now, speaking to that, my father is a Republican. I am the wild-eyed liberal of the family. And having just spoken with him yesterday about some of these issues and some of these topics, it finally hit me all over again, I should say, that the rank and file of the Republican Party, the scared old white guys, like my dad, they are being trained to think that any solution that comes from liberals or Democrats is wrong. Even if it was originally proposed by a Republican, moment it comes out of a Democrat's mouth, it is wrong. And no matter how many times I have shown him, like, real graphs, like, you know, paper and ink and everything, graphs and, you know, history lessons and all of the other facts, he just brushes them right aside. It's kind of like flipping
up
the hem of the apron. And considering I'm also the only member of my family that's ever been to college.
But that's, you know what, and I thank you for the call, Mary, and that's how fascists operate. I'm sorry, but whether you're the Khmer Rouge, whether you're Dan Quayle, whether you're the SS, and I'm not comparing them to Nazis, what I'm saying is fascism demonizes smart people and tells you don't trust the academics, don't trust the university professors, don't trust anyone wearing glasses. Listen to us, because we're one of you.
and it elevates dumbness, and they don't want smart Americans. They don't want critical thinkers. They want dumb, mouth-breathing, consumer, obedient sheep.
And we've got a lot of those now.
Yeah, and you know what? It's like critical thought is good, and if more Republicans experienced critical thought, they would have actually handed over the White House to a conservative instead of George W. Bush, who was not a conservative, according to the dictionary.
And he didn't win.
And he didn't You're very right about that. Hey, I want to bring up do we have a time for a cool story, Chris?
Yeah, absolutely.
Jane Fonda was supposed to be on QVC to promote her new book called Primetime. It's a book she wrote about aging.
Uh-huh.
And QVC abruptly removed Jane Fonda from the lineup when viewers threatened to boycott QVC if she showed up on the air.
Really?
Because of Vietnam, of course, yeah. And Edie, did you ever work with Jane? Do you know Jane?
I have not met Jane. I did see her filling her gas tank at a self-serve one time, and I just kind of lingered, hopefully.
Right.
Yeah.
She pumps her own gas. Wow.
Yes, but it's commie gas.
Yeah, well, you know, I've never met her either. I have met Peter, and what a fun cat that is, let me tell you, man.
Yeah.
Peter Fonda is the hype, and he should have won the Oscar for Yulee's Gold over Nicholson in 97.
Oh.
But these people always want to be angry at Jane Fonda, and they want to spit on her because she did, admittedly, some ill-advised, stupid things. She protested the Vietnam War, as many moral people did. The way she did it, I think, was not very productive and didn't help the cause.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
But here's the thing. All these people that want to protest Jane Fonda and call her Hanoi Jane and hate on her because she wanted to bring the troops home from an immoral war, you ever notice these people aren't angry at the civilian leadership who sent our young men off to die in this war? They're not angry at Nixon or Kissinger or LBJ. They're angry at a young girl who did something to try to bring them home.
Mm-hmm.
They're never angry at the men who sent them off on lies to die. They're not angry at LBJ for lying about the Tet Offensive. They're not angry at Kissinger for escalating the war, spreading into Cambodia. They're not angry at McNamara. They're not angry at all the men who enabled the deaths and maimings of thousands of young men who decimated a generation. They're angry at her.
Yeah.
Do you guys ever notice that that's kind of disgusting morally?
Yes.
In a word.
You know, to me, it's outrageous. And you don't have to be a fan of Jane Fonda to do this. And again, I say that I think that what she did being photographed with the Viet Cong was pretty dumb and hurt the anti-war movement.
Yeah.
But, you know, again, these people come out and say, she spit in our faces for 37 years. What about the people who spit in the faces of these veterans, who sent them off to die, and then let the ones who came home go homeless and go neglected? It's incredible to me, the morality of these people who are just getting off on hate like they're huffing paint fumes behind a shed.
I blame Jane Fonda for high-impact aerobics and all the injuries it caused.
Yeah, well, that I hate her for, yes. And I hate her for making feathered hair too prominent among over 40 women in the 80s. That was unconscionable. And I blame her for Monster-in-Law. You know, pick at her for Monster-in-Law.
Oh, come on. That was an entertaining little fluff of a movie.
Well, I was on that flight, Chris, and it was not an entertaining little fluff of a movie.
You know what? I actually saw it on a flight, too.
Sorry if I would saw it.
Yeah.
Now, back in the day, during the Vietnam War, I was working for an NPR station in Kansas City, and the March on Washington was going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And one of my students came to me and said that he wanted to go.
Mm-hmm.
And he didn't know if he was going to be able to get back, you know, in time to come to class. And I said, I'm not going to mark you absent at all. I wish I could go, but I can't. So you go and represent me at the March on Washington. And he said, and he did get arrested. So he didn't make it back to class very soon, but it was a time when there was an amalgamation of the youth, and they did the conviction. They followed their convictions.
Sure.
And I don't see that happening a whole lot now.
I agree. I would have liked to have seen more
of it. Everybody's
on
their iPhone doing what? I don't know.
Yeah, I
playing
know.
Playing Angry Birds.
Yeah.
But you know what? We saw more young people than ever turn out to vote for Barack Obama in 2008. And even if you're disappointed with how Obama's governed, and you know, some of us who criticize him are doing that because we support him and want to see him get reelected. But even if you're disappointed, you can't help but be astonished and impressed by how many young people got engaged in the political process for the first time and voted for the first time. I really think that everyone's saying now, oh, no one's going to show up and vote in 2012. Those first-time voters did it for a novelty, but they're not going to be there for Obama. Let me tell you, when they see their choices are Rick Perry and Marco Rubio ticket or the Romney, Michelle Bachmann ticket, trust me, a lot of people who are indifferent now are going to get motivated in 2012 to show up and vote.
Yep.
Well, there are a couple of light notes. Newt Gingrich campaign is on life support now.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And it's almost out. And Sarah Palin's documentary premiere open to a nearly empty audience.
Yep, in Orange County. Yeah. And yet Fox News still said the theaters were packed for her opening weekend.
Liar, liar, pants on fire.
Yeah. But they did, of course, they didn't show any video because, or if it was, it was stock photo of, you know, a Harry Potter opening.
They're packed with crash test dummies.
Yeah, they were packed with the souls of dead wolves shot from helicopters. It's true, and it's pretty hilarious to see that kind of propaganda going on Fox, that they're still promoting Sarah Palin. And that's the surest sign, by the way, that Sarah Palin will not be running for president because she's still taking her paycheck from the lamestream media.
Yeah.
Newt Gingrich and Rick Santorum were both put on hiatus. They're paid commentators on Fox, and they stopped taking a salary. Fox is still sending Sarah Palin a check, folks, every week. She is the lamestream media. She works for the most popular cable news channel there is, and that's who she criticizes. So she's definitely not running. And, Edie, you're right, but I would say to you that I don't think Newt Gingrich was ever seriously running for president. I think Newt Gingrich was running for higher public speaking fees, and that's it. He's going to show up at the debates. He's going to come off as being marginally intelligent while he just spouts George Bush economic policies with new adjectives in them. And he's going to get another 10 years of ringing up a credit card bill at Tiffany's because he does well in these debates. That's all he's trying to do. I think only Pawlenty and Huntsman and Romney are the only ones who are really running for president. The rest of them are all just running for fame. So there you go.
Thank you.
Yeah. Can I ask you guys a question?
Yeah.
Herman Cain. I love Herman Cain because I'm a thinker. And, Herman Cain came out and he really wants to ban mosques, and he thinks that people should be allowed to ban mosques in their community because religious freedom, you know, the Constitution only goes so far, and some religions are more equal than others. Here's my question, and I want to phrase this very carefully. I don't want to offend anybody. Is there a reason that Herman Cain is allowed in these debates? Because Gary Johnson is the former governor of New Mexico, and he's a libertarian, but he's a Republican running for president, an elected official. He was not invited to that most recent presidential debate, even though he was a governor of a big state. Herman Cain, who sells crappy pizza, was invited. Why is that? Is that because he's going to make us all feel better about the evil things they're going to say?
Because the powers that be don't think that... That Johnson, is that his name?
Yeah.
They don't think he's a real Republican.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, you cannot be pro-pot and be a Republican, according to the GOP powers that be.
And yet Ron Paul's allowed to be there, too.
Yeah.
Rather interesting. I know we have to go to a break. Yep. Let's do that. We'll be back for the waning moments of the Stephanie Miller Show with Edie McClurg, Jim Ward, and Chris Lavoie. I'm John Fugelsang. It's been a blast. We'll still try to take your calls at 1-800-STEPH-1-2. Don't go away.
Everything everyone just said is either obvious or wrong.
It's the Stephanie Miller Show.
It's the Stephanie Miller Show. This is John Fugelsang.
Stephanie Miller.
It's the Stephanie Miller Show. This is John Fugelsang filling in for Stephanie Miller. That was your own personal Jesus, which Johnny Cash actually covered.
Check it out.
It's a great, great, great cover song.
And Edie McClurg is doing some chair dancing in here. You can see it on Ustream at ustream.tv/Stephanie Miller.
So I want to give one brief announcement. We are playing the next date of the Stephanie Miller Sexy Liberal Comedy Tour. Phase 2 of the tour begins August 6th. In Santa Fe, New Mexico, with myself, Stephanie Miller, and Ms. Aisha Tyler joining the lineup. We're really excited. We have two shows on that day. The evening show is completely sold out. However, the theater is holding back some donor seats. They have released some now for the 3 p.m. show only. There are still tickets at the Lensic for the 3 p.m. You can go to Lensic, LENSIC.org for tickets. For me, Stephanie, and Aisha, how can anyone say no?
That's right.
Does that mean, since it's only in Arizona, it isn't all the way across the continent, that Stephanie will be back on Monday?
Well, New Mexico.
That's in New Mexico, yes.
So
Stephanie
it isn't
will.
All the way. Yeah,
yeah, so,
yeah, you'll have her back. I kind of fought. I wanted some Edie time. I dropped an extra roofie to Stephanie's drink. Yeah, what are you going to do? I got great taste in women.
Your wife is lovely.
Oh, I'm glad you finally got to meet my wife.
Yes,
yeah.
Gorgeous.
She was
gal.
So excited to get to hang out with you. My
Ooh.
God. Yeah, my wife and her foxy friend Karen, like, were sitting on the stoop listening to Edie tell stories about shooting Carrie until 2 in the morning. It was the most fun. I want to just say what we've learned today. We've learned if you want to audition for Robert Redford and you get in the room with him, play with your pants.
Mm-hmm.
We've learned that 20% of all income earned in America goes to the top 1% of individuals, and that's why the Kardashians and Paris Hilton need another tax cut. And we've learned that Marcus Bachmann is a clean-shaven man with a very attractive beard. So what's coming up for you this week, Edie?
Let's see, where am I going now? Nothing much.
Well, Cars 2 is still out in theaters.
Cars 2
That's
is.
Right.
Oh, and really building a big dollar amount on it's very popular with the kids, and that's wonderful.
Indeed. Yep.
Indeed.
Because they want to see it over and over again.
And you were in a Target commercial as your character in Cars 2, right?
Yeah, scooching on through, boys.
I want to come back in my next life as one of Edie McClurg's residual checks.
Yeah, you wouldn't want to come back as one of mine. They're disappearing.
Yeah.
You wouldn't want to come back as one of mine. Oh, my Becker appearance aired again. Wow.
Yeah, right.
Wow, that's CSI something. That is something that you and Jim Ward have in common.
I was on a couple episodes of Becker.
Oh, were you?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I was on. I did a Becker. I did a CSI. I got shot and killed on CSI. That was fun.
I got killed in Spider-Man. This first Spider-Man.
That's
movie.
Right. That's right. I was on the Michael Richards show. I know you didn't have that.
Oh, wow.
Because that was on the air for about 30 seconds.
It was
now,
just before the.
I was
the,
on a CSI where I was the proprietor of an adult baby fetish store.
Oh my god.
Oh yeah.
And Republican congressman came to visit you. No doubt.
Wow, how tawdry for
and
CSI.
And I look at Grissom and I say, yo, oh, let's see, what are you, about a 34, 36?
diaper.
Oh, God. My only scene with Grissom was me lying in a pool of fake cornstarch blood as he walked over me. With the entire CSI team dressed like European runway models.
Right.
Now, is that stuff hard to get off, that fake blood stuff?
Oh, let me tell you, it ruined. I was wearing, like, this really expensive wardrobe. It was ruined by this stuff. Yeah.
But fortunately, you're already pale enough to look like a corpse.
Well,
so
exactly. I was actually the first actor they ever had to darken to play a corpse. I want to thank you guys for making my Monday such a pleasant experience. It's always a lot of fun coming in and guest hosting for Steph, and I will be joining her again this Friday for the full three. Chris, I just love what you do.
Aw, thank you.
You awe me with your talent. Edie, I could listen to you all day. I just think you make me proud of my species. And I want to thank all of Steph's callers as well and listeners for all the great calls, all the great comments I've gotten on Twitter. I am at John Fugelsang on Twitter, but you have to know how to spell Fugelsang, which is why I don't have more followers. And on Facebook as well. Please, folks, please take the time to follow Sexy Liberal on Twitter and on Facebook. Please like us. The tour is coming to a town near you, and it is doing the Lord's work. I thank you guys very much. You've been a bunch of princes. And we will be back tomorrow with Steph back here in the chair. And I leave you just saying, you know, anyone who wants to complain about getting old, consider the alternative. Thank you very much. Have a great day.